OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
You're welcome along to OTB AM. It's Johnny Ward and Andy Lee bringing you through the start of this Tuesday morning as we settle into life looking at the future of the Irish rugby team and the Irish football team. Lots of coverage in the papers today saying that basically we need to change. We need to play a different style of football. We need to educate our kids differently, particularly in rugby. And if we're ever to get closer to the likes of New Zealand and the better football teams, things need to change. And we will talk about that. We will have Rory O'Connor on the show. We've plenty coming up. Before all of that, Andy Lee, how are you?
Grand, Johnny.
I think I might have a little problem with my mic here, which I may solve in a moment. What's the crack? I was on the couch last night and I didn't know you were on this morning, but you came into my head. You came into my head. Do you know why?
Why?
I was watching the Dublin Murders.
Oh, yeah?
And...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not a bad shout.
We actually... Mo Dunford, yeah. It's not a bad
shout. Mo Dunford? Yeah. Should be on the screen there, I think.
Had that a few times.
Have you?
I met Mo... we were supposed to do a TV show one time, but we actually got... We were supposed to go out live... We're in the green room and then it got cancelled because there was a big Brexit announcement.
Oh, really?
So we had to go back. We're in Cork. But
He can, if ever there's a movie of Andy Lee, I think he'd be...
He's not a bad shout. There's actually, I don't want to say too much, but there's someone's trying to option the book, my book, for a film. And if I have my choice, I think I'd go with Will Poulter, who's a young actor.
I
don't think he looks like me too much, but I really like him as an actor. Will Poulter.
He has to look vaguely like you, though, doesn't he?
Yeah. I don't know. I just like him. But Mo's a good actor. Mo could do the job.
Will Poulter, yeah. Don't know if we can get Will Poulter on the screen there.
Might be a bit too soon.
Will Poulter, 26.
Yeah.
Yeah, which would be, I guess, when you're at your prime.
In the wheelhouse, yeah. In that kind of... but Mo would be a good shout too, yeah.
All joking aside though, if it were turned into a movie, is there enough there to make it into like...
Is there enough drama?
Content and...
I don't know, these people seem to think so. I'm just going with the flow.
Yeah.
And seeing where it goes. Yeah, so we'll see.
I read a piece in The Athletic that Daniel Taylor wrote about... Brian Clough meeting these two basically down and out kids from Newcastle, and he just met them on an away trip and he ended up moving one of them in with the family for a year. And Daniel Taylor was making the point that they could literally write a book or make a movie on this alone. And Brian Clough, of all the quotes he came out with, he never referenced this amazing generosity, and he was the most famous man in football, I think, at the time. And great stories about one particular story about Roy Keane looking down and thinking he'd scored a goal, and he looked down at his shorts after scoring, and he realised that he was getting really excited by scoring a goal, and he brought it up. I'd never seen this before, and I was the banter with Stuart Pearce about it. It's an amazing little piece by Daniel Taylor if you can read it, but that movie could happen.
Yeah, but like for those two lads who they could write a book, because when you live with somebody like that, you see them, not that the most vulnerable, with their guard down, you know.
Yeah.
You see behind the curtain, like, I live with Emmanuel Stewart, and, like, one day Emmanuel would be, like, wherever he would be, in Hollywood, he'd be on HBO, he'd be doing these things, and I'd be seeing him, you know, running around the house in his underwear, you know.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, looking for his hair dye and stuff like that, and asking me to give him a hand, and, like, those are the kind of, you don't see behind the veil. But, look. If Leonardo DiCaprio wants to play me in a film, I won't be arguing with him.
You heard it here first. We've plenty coming up on OTB AM over the next 2 hours, which I don't think is going to include anything about Leonardo DiCaprio taking the role of Andy Lee in a movie. But Rory O'Connor will be with us from 8 a.m. to talk about the future of Irish rugby and how can Andy Farrell put his stamp on things. Here's Keith Wood on that matter.
Well, I think he has the relationship because he's been there for a few years. He's an incredibly personable guy. I know they rate him very highly. But I don't know. I don't take your premise that he has to do it to the same granular level. I think that's Joe's style.
Okay.
And whatever Andy's style is, and I don't know how you define it. I don't know how he defines it. I think it'll be an interesting question to ask him whenever we get a chance. But his view is he'll want to be his man and he'll want to do it his way. And even though Joe Schmidt has delivered a huge amount of success for Irish rugby, it's come at a particular time when we haven't had success in the last little period of time. So we're not going to continue in that exact same way anyway. And I would look back on all the coaches I had with Ireland or at club teams or whatever. Coaches have a different way of looking at things. Joe's way could be absolutely perfect for a lot of the players that play, and it obviously was, and it definitely was over the last number of years, and suited some of the players and the players' personalities incredibly well. But if you have a different coach, what's to say he won't have a different outlook entirely? What's to say he won't want to play more off the cuff, or he wants to look for different types of characters and he doesn't want it to be as organized, you know? And what's to say that that won't be successful either?
How much of a job is Andy Farrell, do you think?
Oh, I think it's a bit rebuilding confidence, isn't it? That's like, there's no different. Well, from last year to this year, the players are generally the same, but it's just maybe age and having that success. And I don't know. I think there's a number of factors, obviously, with them and the mentality side of it, because they were successful. I don't think they rested on their laurels, but I think maybe building up the World Cup to be more than it is or should have been and putting pressure on themselves. He's definitely got to bring in younger players just to freshen it up, and that's the challenge for him. I don't think it's probably not a physical thing, or some way it might be ability and a little bit of skills, but it's definitely mentality.
Would you, if you were a team coach, would you be ruthless in the terms of some players probably need to go now? There needs to be probably some sort of if not a purge, like a bit of ruthlessness in terms of I think when Stephen Kenny comes in from Mick McCarthy, some of the players will definitely they need to make a transition. But would you be like a kind of a softly coach, you think, or would you be like, listen?
I think you'd have to assess what's there and who you have coming behind, and if they're better, or even if they're equally as good, then there's a genuine like shout for changing the team completely, like having a clear out. But it depends on this, if the strength is there, you know, if there are the younger players coming through. But there seems to be. It's difficult, isn't it? It's not difficult. It's like, I probably would say give it a complete fresh start, you know, and like if. But then how much pressure does he come in if they get if all these young players get completely wiped out in the Six
Nations?
Gotta
be patient, I suppose. Yeah. In terms of your own coaching, what's your style yourself? Like, and how much is boxing coaching down to do with getting inside the boxer's mind and basically telling him or her that, you know, he or she is great? And how much of it is to do with actual coaching techniques?
I think a lot, like in boxing, the training... And the training is probably 80% physical, 20% mental. But when you're fighting, it's completely different. It's 80% mental and 20% physical. And you could probably relate, because it's like horse racing. You have a horse trainer, but then you also have a jockey. You know, and in a fight sense, you're more of a jockey because you got to steer them through this fight. But I think confidence is huge, and giving a fighter confidence. I don't think I would come down too hard on them if they haven't performed well, but because you have to understand what they're going through, and when you're coaching them day in and day out, you can see that and how much of a struggle it is. And if you haven't had a good day, you probably know why.
Yeah.
You're probably as much, not to blame for it, but you're probably as much for a reason for it as well if you've been pushing them hard or what. But it's different. And in terms of my start, I'm coaching the two lads now, Paddy Donovan and Jason Quigley. I'm still finding my style because I'm still new to it as well. But it's definitely giving them confidence, but also knowing what's expected of them. In terms of like Paddy, he had his first fight last week, so it's still a new experience for him. But in interviews and in things I've been saying, even in passing when he's been in earshot, letting him know what's expected of him. He had a first round knockout, and even though he was delighted with it, and I was quite happy with it as well, but I want to let him know that was what you're supposed to do.
Yeah,
that's your job.
You can't get too high about this because, yeah. You know, like if he celebrates that and he's in his head, he's going out, oh yeah, I'm great, yeah. Like, well.
Yeah. And you could see when he won, there was no jumping on the top rope, yeah. But, you know, cheering because, listen, this is...
How was he received in Belfast?
Very good. He's only a kid, he's 20 years old, but he has... people are attracted to him, he's got a charisma, you know, something about him, but... Like, before I even had a fight, I would take him with me to the professional fights, and people were, like, queuing up to get a photograph with him, and he hadn't even had a fight yet, you know, so... He's got a bit of star quality.
He has a bit of a kind of a movie star look about him, yeah. As well, doesn't he?
And
you're telling me boxing goes through the family like at least two generations.
Yeah, well, I was telling you before, his grandfather has a Mike Tyson facial tattoo, so I guess he had to box. There was no there was no option for him.
His background is interest from the travelling community as well, and. Without, like, I suppose, going into it too much because we don't have time, really, but he must have the potential to be an icon for travelling people because this guy obviously is seriously, potentially very good.
In this country, definitely. Mm. He has the ability to, like, he has the ability to be a star in boxing at world level, you know.
Really?
Definitely. But he has to keep his feet on the ground, and me saying all these things aren't going to help.
Yeah.
You know, he has to keep his... That's his main challenge now, is living the lifestyle outside of the ring when he's not in the gym, and working hard and just remaining focused. Because you can see somebody like him, he's a good-looking young kid, a young lad, and, like, could easily go to his head, you know, easy. He has a heritage of boxing. His brothers are European champions, like world medalists as amateurs. His dad was a good fighter, and yes, serious talent.
How much within the travelling community in general? How boxing's obviously quite like a few travellers have come out and be proper boxers. So there is a kind of an inclination there to get into boxing.
Well, I know myself. It leads. The travelling way of life and boxing, they kind of go hand in hand because you're from a disadvantage, not a disadvantage, but yeah, disadvantage background.
You are, and absolutely.
So you grow up with a chip on your shoulder and you always feel like you're not made, you've not always made to feel like you're not equal. And so with that, you always want to prove yourself and show that you're equal, and then in boxing show that you're actually better than equal. And so, boxing thrives in disadvantaged backgrounds. You know, you look at any tough area in the world, if there's a boxing gym, there'll be success. And there's no, like, I don't think, the two things are definitely, there's definitely a correlation because it's a way out and you don't need a lot of expensive gear to be a boxer. You can just turn up. And but particularly in the travelling world, because it's a male, in a way, it is still a male-dominated society, very old-fashioned, in terms of the social dynamic. And it's an alpha male kind of, amongst men, like, weakness is not really shown, you know? And so you have to be strong. That's, for good or bad, that's the way it is at the moment. And that leads to breeding good fighters.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating because I did a piece last Friday on Castlereagh Prison that they brought in this horse welfare system where horses are brought into the prison, and about 30% of the population in Castlereagh are travellers, so it's quite a... But because people recognise in racing that travellers have a great affinity with the horses, they want to bring these guys back into society, so let them kind of work as if they're in a stable and live a normal life, and hopefully racing will benefit, and the guys in the prison, be they travellers or non-travellers, can then have some purpose as well. And I thought it was a fantastic initiative.
We've done a piece in here with Nicholas Cruz, the Cuban coach, who's teaching Port Leash prison now boxing and meditation in Spanish, and what an outlet that is, like, for rehabilitation. But
Cuban president in Ireland, of course, at the moment.
Is it?
Yeah, he is. He met Leo last night. We have a packed show coming up already at 7:15, actually. Football with Gary Breen at 8 o'clock. Rory O'Connor, 8:25. Charlie, the GAA's lost icon. That's a new book by Paul Fitzgerald about the life of Charlie Gallagher. It's coming up around 8:45. We'll have Phil Egan in. Hopefully Phil might do an impression this morning. The last time he bottled out of it, apparently he has a repertoire. He wouldn't do Mick McCarthy, he wouldn't do Graeme Souness, he wouldn't do anyone. So the pressure's on Phil Egan, if you're listening, Phil. That's 9:05. And then at 9:20 we'll be talking to Aer Lingus College Football Classic. We'll be talking to the Aer Lingus College Football Classic with Josh Whitman, the athletics director of the Illinois University. He will be joining Adrian Barry. That's around 9:20. Do you want to start with the sports pages there, Andy? What's taking your eye?
I haven't had a good look at these yet, but
you had one job.
I know. My taxi driver had one job as well, and he was late. I got the Irish Daily Star. My job on the line, Pochettino. Poch accepts second risk. What do you think? Do you think he's really risk? He's surely got a lot of goodwill built up.
Yeah.
And this team's just not pulling together.
Yeah, I'd say there's kind of no smoke without fire in terms of the rumours of not all the salacious rumours, but the rumours of just people not being happy. I remember Nathan Murphy interviewing Ericsson.
I heard that rumour.
Yeah. Well, Ericsson, to me, at that stage, it was quite clear that he wanted out, and Spurs didn't let him go. Ericsson's been miles below his best this season. You know, I haven't really seen him for Denmark, but for Spurs he hasn't been at his best, and Spurs probably without Eriksen aren't a great side, and there does seem to be a bit of a collective. I don't know if he's under pressure or not, to be honest. I mean, I do know if he's gone, he'll be snapped up quickly. And it's the same in the Times as well. Times non-edition, Pochettino, my job's at risk. And he said, for the first time, his job is under threat unless results improve. They've won 3 of 12 matches in all competitions this season and are in danger of being knocked out of the Champions League if they don't beat Red Star Belgrade tonight. We're going to talk to Gary Breen about that. United kick-out fan for racism. Manchester United fan was thrown out at Old Trafford on Sunday for allegedly hurling racist abuse at Trent Alexander-Arnold. What's your take on all that? I don't know if there's an easy answer to the racist.
It's creeping back in, isn't it? Like, in all this campaign of push it out and race it, like, how is it actually working, or is it actually the message getting across? But apparently United was very swift in it, like getting the fan out of there. That's got to be the only thing they can do, isn't it? Get them out straight away and take action.
Have you listened to any John Barnes stuff on racism? I think he's fairly nailed on.
He seems to be.
Because, like, people are racist, like, whether they like it or not. It's kind of, that's the way you're brought up. Do you know what I mean? And, like, I would think Irish people are very racist towards travellers, for example.
Yeah, it's educational and a cultural thing, isn't it? It's not...
It's like, oh, I'm not a racist. Yeah. But it's like, well, do you know, then, if you actually go deep enough, I think we all have some cultural kind of stuff going on that we probably, if you delve deeply enough, but how football deals with it, it's tricky.
I know, but it's not really football's problem.
No.
That's what he says, isn't it? It's society's problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What else do we have?
The Herald Sport, keen target in Euro fight, Spurs squad still have belief despite 1-7. Harry Kane says, underfight Tottenham side are up for the fight in Champions League tonight. So, yeah, just basic stuff like that. Mayo deny O'Leary's ticket claims over 100 tickets.
What's this about?
I've not really been, but I think Mayo GAA has refuted a claim that their flagship sponsor is in receipt of 100 All-Ireland tickets at the cost of the board. And they're saying that, no, all tickets were paid up in full. So it's a bit of a...
Yeah. It's
fun. Back and forth.
Yeah, it seems to be a thing now that you can kind of go through the media to question the county board. These are obviously all claims. So Mayo, the county board, has refuted a claim. This is the back of the Independent, so it's the main story. Mayo refused O'Leary ticket claim. Tim O'Leary's the millionaire Mayo backer. He stepped up the challenge to the county board over financial governance. Obviously, clear echoes of what's going on in Galway here as well, with the county board under considerable scrutiny. Jonathan Higgins, who is often on off the ball, he's a tweet last night about the search for Micheál Donoghue, which looks to be actually going, Micheál Donoghue's replacement, which looks to be going nowhere at the moment. But this is obviously a fairly serious question for the Mayo County Board to come back. And an interesting one down the bottom, Schmidt still highly thought of in New Zealand, says World Cup winner Donald. Anything else?
Nothing on the back of the Irish Daily Mail. Sharp blades. Sheffield United getting the win over Arsenal last night.
bit of a shock result. Was it for me? Maybe?
Yes and no. Like, yeah, yes and no. Fair play to the Irish contingent. I think we've, on the Sun, we have John Egan and Dave McGoldrick, both on the back there celebrating.
I just want a great photo. Well,
yeah.
Brian, did you see that putt yesterday?
No.
Did you see it?
No.
He held like a pretty good putt now from a good distance out from on a birdie at some charity tournament they're playing. But like Tiger Woods
no.
and Tindall and
do we have
Rory.
Footage? We can't play the footage, but my producer, Tommy Rooney, is suitably impressed.
All-star lineup.
That's actually an ad for the FAI Cup final on the back, because the title sponsor, Extra.ie, with Daily Mail, which is nice to see.
It is Dundalk vs Shamrock Rovers.
Any interest in going? Can I convince you to go along?
Yeah, why not? Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have 15 quid?
I definitely might.
Might. Yeah.
No, definitely, I would go along. I kind of conflict. Like, I live in Dublin 8, so I'm probably a St. Pat's man.
I live in Dublin 8.
Yeah.
Up and coming area.
I've had a bit of contact with the Bowes manager.
Keith Long?
Back and forth. Yeah, so maybe I could. Bowes seem to be a cool team.
They are. They're the hipster
Richie
team.
Richie McCormick.
Richie McCormick.
He kind of informs me that, but...
What were you talking to Keith Long about?
Your
movie. Go on.
No, not at all. We were just talking about teams and this and that, yeah. So maybe I'd go in and have a chat with them and talk to the players and stuff, but I've never done that type of thing, so I'm a bit intimidated, I guess.
I think their last game of the season, Friday, is effectively sold out already. They've really galvanised the community there. I do like this in the back of the Sun. It's getting hairy, and here's how Poch might look with grey hair, which, you know, kind of like, what's that face app or whatever? United Trent Race Row as well on the back. I want to bring you up on this one, actually. This is in the back of the Guardian, and this is prevalent in so many of the papers today. Study confirms link between footballers and dementia. And Jeff Astle died in 2002 with the sport blamed. And quite appallingly here, former professional footballers are 3.5 times more likely to suffer from dementia and other serious neurological diseases, a landmark study has found. And this was a 22-month research project by the University of Glasgow's Brain Injury Group. I don't like to say it, but whatever football has in this regard, I can't imagine boxing is doing too well.
Yeah. I don't think it's any secret. I know maybe a bit of revelation in football now, but in boxing it's kind of accepted. Or you know, it was kind of funny because we were in the dressing room last week with Paddy Donovan, and he's getting ready for his first pro fight, 20 years old, a world at his feet, and the inspector, I won't mention his name, just out of for the boxing board up in Belfast, well-known man, but good age, and the reminders of the dangerous spot were there. Not for Paddy, I'm not sure if he wasn't aware of it, but this inspector was walking in, and he must have walked in 5 or 6 times and repeated the same questions. There was a certain amount of damage done from the fights that he'd had, and he was telling us about the fights. He'd go outside, he'd come back and tell us about the fights again, and just repeating himself, you know. And for me, I was sitting there thinking, like, this is Paddy, you know, he's about to go.
It's not like heel prep.
You know, yeah. But I don't think Paddy was even aware of it, you know.
He was just doing it in a kind of conversational style.
Yeah, he was totally unaware. He was just coming in and, you know, there's nobody in the other room. And he'd come in and come back out again 15 minutes later. Oh, there's nobody in the other room. And tell us about, you know, one story about a certain fight that said something to him, and come back in and say it again and say it again. And for me, it was like, you know, I was just thinking, like, geez, you know, this is the two ends of the scale. You know, Paddy just starting his career, and this
man. Oh, I tell you.
You know? Yeah. But like in boxing, it's generally, I can't, like, you know.
Is it
there's a certain amount of old age and people, what? Is it taboo? Yeah, well, injury in boxing. But we've had, like, there's been 4 deaths in boxing since July of this year. And if it continues like this, there's going to have to be, in that speed, there's going to have to be something done about it.
Such as?
It's very hard to see which way they can do it. Like, rule changes, do you destroy the sport? Like, you know, say if a fighter gets knocked down twice, like, you know, whether you give longer than 10 seconds to evaluate a fighter once he's been knocked down, you know. But again, it could destroy the sport, you know, in terms of if a fighter gets knocked down twice in a round, the fight's over. Some jurisdictions and some governing bodies have a 3-knockdown rule.
Mm.
But they could lessen that to 2 knockdowns. But then again, it could, like you would, there's been so many great fights, and why people love fights, these knock back and forth, comeback fights.
Mm.
Those would be all gone, you know, if you change the rules like that.
Do you ever worry about your own long term health?
But I'm retired now. But who knows what's down the line? But like in
what's
some
the point
some,
worrying,
yeah, yeah, and for some point, like what. There's an argument for like live now and have the glory. Anything can kill you. You know what I mean? Anything you might like. I'm sure there are people with dementia who have never hit the ball or been hit in the head in their life. Things happen. You know, whatever it might be, Alzheimer's and things. You know, these diseases are there. You might get them anyway. But why not live now and enjoy it and do all that you want to do.
I dare say that football is changing anyway. That's, you know, there's definitely not as much heading of the ball.
And the balls are a lot lighter.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make a difference? I've often like, you know, now that I don't box, when you're boxing, you're taking punches and you're training, you build your face, but like the tissues build up with toughness.
Mm.
But I've often been like, I'm retired 2 years now, but like play the odd game of soccer, and when you do head the ball, the next day you feel like, you know, you get that bruise on your skin. Do you ever feel that little soreness on your skin, like, you know? So I was wondering.
It's mad.
Do you ever feel that?
No.
I feel like from heading the ball.
Try not to head the ball, but.
I'm just a big lump, so I have to head.
Yeah. Where do you play football?
We play up in, Dublin 7 up there in Stony Batter, up in the college.
Oh, lovely. Yeah,
the pictures are nice.
Black.
What's the college?
Black
there?
Hall, is it?
The
legal.
Yeah, it's nice.
Eddie Jones, meanwhile, he's been speaking this morning. He reckons that the All Blacks have been spying on. Their training has been spied on this week, which is quite interesting. He reckons the All Blacks have been spying on the England training set. Spygate in rugby. So is there any boxing parallel for this? Here is Eddie Jones, anyway, speaking about the All Blacks allegedly spying on the England coaching sessions.
There's definitely someone in the apartment block filming, but it might have been a Japanese fan.
You didn't send anyone to go?
No. We don't care, mate.
Sorry, you just said that everyone does that. Would you film the All
Blacks? Yeah, we've got someone there now, mate. We've got someone there now.
You answer that question seriously. Would you film another team?
I haven't done it since 2000 and I better get the numbers right here. 2001, we used to do it.
And do you think it's sort of ethically wrong to do that?
Look, you just don't need to do it anymore, mate, because you see everything. Yeah, you can watch everyone's training on YouTube or whatever there is. There's everything out there. There's no value in doing that sort of thing now. Absolutely zero.
Yeah, I do like the mischievous nature of Eddie Jones. It's competition time on OTBAM. All week we're giving you the opportunity to win UEFA Champions League quarterfinal tickets, and that is all thanks to Pepsi Max, who are one of the proud sponsors of the UEFA Champions League. Keep an eye out for their promotional packs, which you can win this week also. And to be in with the chance of winning this morning, just send us a comment wherever you're watching the show of your favourite Champions League goal. Any favourite Champions League goal for you?
Solskjaer, 1999, the final.
What age were you back then?
I would have been about 14.
Similar to me, actually, yeah.
Yeah. Watching it alone, it's great.
Watching it alone?
Yeah, buzzing to myself, not from a family of football, like, coaches, you know? So, yeah.
What were your family into?
Boxing and all.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be big sports fans at that time.
It's Pepsi Max, maximum taste.
Your favourite time?
No sugar.
There's too much.
Sure, any of the Liverpool goals against Milan really were pretty cool. Mm. Obviously, Zidane's goal in the final that time.
Against Arsenal.
It hasn't been much from a League of Ireland perspective, really, no. Robbie Benson's goal against Legia Warsaw, an absolute screamer. I was at that game, 40,000 people Polish crazy fans going over there, and Robbie Benson on his bad foot, and Dundalk were right bang in that game to get into the Champions League right till the death. But in any event, we were back talking football, more football, with Gary Breen after these. OTB
AM. You did forget that he was a loss last week. He has been Ireland's main striker, and because he's only recently become the main striker, his absence probably wasn't really spoken of that much in the analysis of the games. It wasn't like, well, when McGoldrick gets back, that point was only made in passing a couple of times rather than it being the centrepiece. When you consider that Ireland's best performance this year was a home to Georgia, and he sort of knitted things together in terms of holding the ball up and bringing others into the game, and that was probably lacking a bit in Tbilisi in particular, and also in Switzerland. But
we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. Would you have him with two up front, or would you basically play him on his own again?
Well, he's shown that he's good enough to probably play on his own, and that would have been a bit of a concern. Like, when he came into the squad first, he would have been considered like a number 10, like a Wes Hoolihan alternative, but that's because he'd spent a couple of years at Ipswich being very injury prone. You wouldn't have trusted him to last the pace of a game as a leading light. And actually, he's probably surprised people, and he's become a bit of a crowd favourite even with the Ireland fans in terms of his work rate. He wouldn't have been known necessarily as, I think the perception of him would have been as someone who was technically good rather than someone who will put in the yards for you, but he's actually shown that he can do both.
Yeah, we were missing McGoldrick fairly badly in those two Ireland games, to be fair.
Just the energy and the cute. One thing that struck me about the Ireland games, all players, like, I don't know, like, I don't know, whatever the argument with Daniel James pretending to be knocked out, but like, we weren't cute enough in terms of, there were times when like the players we were trying to dribble it out, and they were like physically,
James Coleman in particular,
yeah, like, to go down and win the free kick and buy a bit of respite, like, at times, you know.
Yeah,
I thought that we could have been a little bit cleverer that way and tried to win set pieces, like, up the pitch a little bit more as well, because there were times when that was definitely on, when you say go down now, you're going to get, but they just, like, were a bit honest and just kept going, you know, a bit too honest.
Gary Breen is on the line. Gary, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Not a bad weekend on the Irish, kind of in the Irish abroad front. Obviously, Sheffield United doing so well last night. Ryan Manning notching a goal for QPR. You know, in fairness, we had a start as well for Brady, his first start in ages. So things not looking too bad for some of the Irish players in England at the very least.
No, they're not. And I know this is obviously a massive topic of debate, but James McCarthy as well, he's getting his minutes at Crystal Palace. He starts in that win against West Ham. He'd been frustrated not to start against Manchester City, but I think that bodes well. I think certainly James McCarthy, we've been saying it for so many seasons now, and he's just had those injury problems that struggle. But if you could get him back in and amongst that team, it would be a massive boost for that game against the Danes, because I think we need someone of his quality in central midfield. I think Glenn Whelan does a job, but playing up against Eriksen in that 10 area, they're wide people coming in from outside and playing just behind our midfield unit. Glenn won't be able to do it on his own. He couldn't do it on his own at 25, let alone 35. So I think we certainly need some quality in there alongside him.
Yeah, we'll talk Christian Eriksen shortly and Tottenham. Where are you generally on the Ireland situation? What chance do you give us against Denmark?
Oh, listen, I'll give us a big chance. Obviously, the momentum that Mick built initially has certainly slowed down. Those last two performances were disappointing. Mick was quite bullish afterwards, saying he took the draw in Georgia. The reality is we should be going to Georgia and winning. And if you look at the scenarios over the last couple of campaigns, whoever drops points in Georgia, invariably it affects their qualification. Scotland win the driving seat. They lost points there. We profited. And then obviously when Denmark dropped points, we felt, oh, this is a great opportunity for us to take advantage. We didn't. So it is frustrating. I think the Swiss team were comfortably better than us. That was no real surprise. And of the two games that remained, I always felt that Denmark at home was our best chance of qualifying.
Absolutely, yeah. So the weekend's action, Manchester United won, Liverpool won. This is a game, unfortunately. Did you see it, Andy?
I watched most of it, yeah.
Yeah, what you make of it?
United seem to be the better team, surprisingly, on top. They seem to have a good game plan in terms of the back three and then the wing-backs. But it'd be interesting to see what Gary thinks. Like, I've seen some quotes saying that they've turned a corner. So I'm just saying, is it just a one-off because it's Liverpool and it's almost like a cup match? You know, how will they do against Norwich next week? You know,
Exactly. I mean, I was impressed in terms of how they performed, and you know, a lot's been made of it was a tactical, really good performance tactically with split strikers. We saw that system what he played at Tottenham last year, which was ultimately a definitive result in terms of going up against Pochettino, going to Tottenham and winning. But the reality was that it was only a first half performance. De Gea had to make 11 saves in that second half, and likewise again, they start well, but they just can't maintain it, and ultimately. They can produce performances like this because they're good footballers. But the difference is they're not consistently good footballers. They're not Manchester United quality, and they won't be challenging up the top. They'll revert to type soon enough.
How much was Salah missed?
It was a huge miss. But I was surprised by it all at Liverpool, Johnny, in terms of how much the game and the occasion affected them. Now, we're talking about a team that's got to show that character to go on and win a title now, Champions League winners as such. But even Jurgen Klopp, I know he's quite demonstrative, he's animated at the best of times, but he was affected by it. It seemed like the occasion was that big for him, but they soon got it right. He showed his qualities in terms of how quickly he changed the system. I think he played three different systems in that second half to really put United on the back foot. And it was no surprise that they did get their goal, because I never felt like that United would keep him out for the 90 minutes.
There's nothing wrong with getting a 1-1 draw at Manchester United. Like, in fairness, Manchester United defensively are solid this season. They went 1-0 behind, as limited as they are. It's still a huge game. Nothing wrong with getting a 1-1 there. But my thing, what I put to you is, Liverpool kind of need to win the league from the situation. They've rather fallen into a situation where I don't think they've necessarily been at their best. They fell into a situation where they went 8 points clear, and whatever about last year, they kind of shouldn't be able to. They shouldn't be letting this slip, to my mind.
No, I don't. I agree with you there. I feel that everyone associated with Liverpool, from the club to the supporters to the media, this really expect now a Premier League title. It's the elusive title that they haven't been able to get. I know they've been able to win Champions Leagues as such, but it's the league that they want more than anything else. They're in a great position, of course, they are. You can't really see him slipping up ultimately because of the fact that City have so many problems at centre-half. And I know that they'll beat most of the teams in the Premier League, but when they come up against the stronger ones, that will be exposed. But I look at Liverpool and I just feel that Klopp has done a brilliant job. They've evolved, because if you think of them a couple of seasons ago, it was literally we attack, you attack, and the goals were going in, flying in. Last season, they had a bit more control about and they dominated games to the extent where people were starting to question why weren't they getting so many goals, notably that front three. But that's what you need to be able to do. You need to be able to win when you're not playing particularly well. And they did it. United had an opportunity, but it's no surprise. United just can't ever seem to get that second goal. I think it's an amazing stat in terms of that they've only got one goal, never seem to get the second one. But it's just indicative of where they are and the reduced state of Manchester United. But nevertheless, Liverpool will be delighted that they got out of there with a point.
Was it a tactical success for Solskjaer?
Listen, I don't think you have to be a particular tactical genius to know that if you want to stop Liverpool, you've got to push their fullbacks back. You know, the very fact that Salah was missing enabled them to go 3-for-3 in a way that they wouldn't do up against someone like him. They played well, yes, they did. The split strikers, Pereira being in and around Fabinho, stopping him playing out was a success. He wasn't the usual player that developed Liverpool's rhythm that we normally associate with him. So they did well, but it wasn't rocket science.
What about Liverpool? What have you made of them so far? Like, if you go back to the last five or six games, they kind of wobbled past Chelsea, struggled to beat Sheffield United, struggled to beat Leicester, struggled to beat Red Bull Salzburg. In many respects, didn't beat Manchester United. So, where are you at with them at the moment?
I still think they're in a great position. I think it's unlikely you're going to play brilliant football from the start to the finish, but they're getting the results. And I think ultimately the biggest difference I've noticed is certainly in the beginning of the season was that defensive line really wants to squeeze high up the pitch, try and hold it on the halfway line. And as a result, the opposition can find it quite easy to turn them. You just have to just play balls into the channel and invariably you'd get them turned and you'll get your team up the pitch. So that needs to be ironed out a little bit. I think Gomez initially got the nod at centre-half because he has that brilliant recovery pace, but has struggled a bit, to be perfectly honest. And Matip has come in and been the main man. But at times, he's looked vulnerable in that system. So, and incredibly, Van Dijk didn't look at his brilliant best on the game against United. So they need to work on it. But the positives are also is that the strength and depth they have coming from the bench. Lallana, who's had a terrible time of injuries, comes back and impacts. Oxlade-Chamberlain, Naby Keita as well. So it just shows you that the brilliant squad that he has built there.
You say incredibly about Van Dijk, but this hasn't been anomalous in the sense of the last few games. Initially, no. That Red Bull Salzburg game, even playing for the Dutch as well, I think it was against Belarus, he just all of a sudden looks vaguely vulnerable.
Yeah, well, do you know what it is, Johnny? It's because the game, and this is something that's been he's been accused of throughout his career, because the game is so easy, he kind of switches off and he's got a little bit of arrogance, and you need that. No doubt, he's comfortably the best centre-half in the world. But I just feel that he's feeling a little bit like, yeah, this is easy. And as a result, people are taking advantage of him. I remember initially a goal against Germany where he allowed Gnabry to cut inside. And rather than closing down quickly, he just said, yeah, go and have a shot. And Gnabry put it into the top corner. So this is something that they need to address. He's a brilliant centre-half, but just those concentration levels frustrate you a little bit because at times he finds it too easy and as a result makes silly mistakes.
Mm. Let's talk Tottenham. A lot of the back page is dominated by Pochettino admitting or speculating to some extent that he's under pressure. And obviously tonight they're in Champions League action at home to Red Star Belgrade. Three wins from, was it the last nine? Three wins from the last 12? Three wins from 12, I think, this season. All clearly not well at Tottenham.
No, it isn't. And it's even worse than that. I think they lost 20 games last season. So getting to the Champions League final really papered over the cracks. And they go to this new stadium, brilliant training ground. Everyone's talking about a new era. But I always felt this, and I was consistent with it. I felt it was the end of one, to be perfectly honest, because with each season since they've left White Hart Lane, they've got weaker. They genuinely have got weaker. That team that finished the season at White Hart Lane was so dominant. That was the time to win a Premier League. And they're just drifting away now. And I think the realisation and the frustration that comes from Pochettino is that he knows it. The ceiling's been reached. He goes to the Champions League final, comes to a new stadium. They're in London, in the Premier League with that newfound wealth. He tries to go and get top-class players, proven players, and no one wants to go to Tottenham. They all want to go to United, even though they're having their struggles. They all want to stay at City, Liverpool, even at Juventus, these type of... And this is the frustration that he has, is that he cannot get Tottenham over the line in terms of competing at the highest level. And I genuinely think that this will be the beginning of the end at Tottenham now, because so many of that brilliant team will disband now with no trophy. You're going to lose players for nothing, which is incredible, bearing in mind what a businessman Daniel Levy is. And he said that he'd never be caught out in a way that he was with Sol Campbell going to Arsenal on a free transfer. Where he's going to lose Eriksen, Vertonghen, Alderweireld, all for nothing. And you're talking about best part of £150 million there.
Do you see that in Eriksen's body language as well? That, you know, I was referencing with Andy the interview he gave to Nathan Murphy, where he essentially walked out on the Journalist of the Year after Ireland played Denmark. he wouldn't answer the question. But I was like, well, you know, we've all done these interviews where we're kind of made to look like fools. But in fairness to Nathan, he asked the question. And I was just saying to him, well, obviously Eriksen is gone. But here he is months later still playing for Spurs. But clearly mentally he's not there.
No, and he's not alone. You think about the fact that Danny Rose was left behind in pre-season to go and find a new club. That doesn't happen. Vertonghen, Alderweireld getting to the last 6 months of their contract. It's a nonsense. And you just see that dressing room is unsettled. And as a result, Pochettino is. And the frustration for me is that Pochettino is doing too many of these sound bites now. He's talking about... there's the wrong energy in the change room. Well, a lot of it's coming from him. He was the one who initially said about leaving Tottenham on the eve of a Champions League final and saying that if I want to achieve what I want to do, I might have to go elsewhere. Well, what type of message is that to your players? And Daniel Levy's done a brilliant job. He's assembled a young, vibrant team and a top-class manager for a fraction of their worth, for half of what they would probably be getting elsewhere, other clubs. But it's come back to bite him now because they're going to leave for nothing.
It's kind of sad as well because they were so, you know, like the season they had last season, weren't a million miles off challenging for the title as well with, as Gary says, their team that was assembled for relatively small amounts, Sandy.
Yeah, but like how long does Pochettino hang around himself before his reputation starts to, you know, be affected if...
You already have your coaching kind of cap on you.
Get him to United.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that, where does he go, Gary? Because I... you know, obviously you don't want to be there and your reputation week by week is getting a bit less, but I imagine he's still like, I guess, top five coaches in the world in terms of a job that he might get.
Oh, yeah, he'd be well sought after, no doubt. Real Madrid has struggled with Zidane at the moment, obviously United. If he becomes available, and this is the pressure that's on Solskjaer in terms of that, is that a lot of the times United will look at a situation with him and say, well, listen, what are our options? There's very little out there. Suddenly, if Pochettino comes on the market, it puts huge pressure on him. In a way, also, that Frank Lampard's doing such a good job at Chelsea that people are comparing the two, or saying, well, why aren't you bringing through quality players like you said you were going to, in a way that Lampard is? So I think it's a difficult one. I don't see Pochettino staying at Tottenham for much longer because I don't believe that he will think he can achieve any more. Because if you're talking about him developing another team, another new cycle, he's already proved that at Tottenham over the last 6 years. He proved it at Southampton in terms of how many players he established into internationals even. He won't want to do it again. He wants trophies. He's that type. And I think he'll look at the situation and think, no, the ceiling's been reached. And I think he will be now looking at his options.
Are they vulnerable tonight?
Well, in terms of how much they're imploding recently, they need a massive win. There's no doubt about it. But the mood's changed. It really has. If you think about how dynamic they were and everyone was pulling in the right direction, they were backing this young sought-after manager. All that seems to have gone out. There seems to be a darker mood around there at Tottenham at the moment. And listen, I would expect them to win against Red Star. They're strong, you know what I mean? They should be stronger than them, but you just don't ever know. Look how Watford nearly went there and won at the weekend.
One other thing I wanted to bring up with you, when Ireland played in Georgia and all the Irish fans were in the bar beforehand and England went behind and Declan Rice was taken off, it was probably the biggest cheer of the whole weekend, I think. But Daniel McDonald...
You've got to put some money in that jar. You've mentioned Declan Rice.
I'm going to mention him again. Daniel McDonald, Grealish may yet prove to be a bigger loss to Ireland cause than Rice. And I think Stan Collymore in his column speaks about Grealish as well, but the basic point, Grealish versus Rice, where are you with that and how much of a loss is Rice to us in terms of the international setup?
In terms of the quality of both players in isolation, it's a huge loss for us in terms of that physicality and holding midfield with Rice and then that creativity at 10 and advanced midfield of Grealish. Massive loss. But the reality is they're not Irish. They've proved it. You know, if they were, they would be playing. And I've always been consistent on this. Go and have an international career with whoever you think you're from.
Well, they're mixed race, aren't they, Gary?
Oh, they're not mixed race, are they?
Why Irish, English?
Well, listen. They're up. The decision is theirs, but I've been quite consistent on this. I don't believe in being able to put on two jerseys. They're eligible. Yeah, I agree with that. But whether or not they actually consider themselves Irish, if they did, they wouldn't have done what they had.
But he would have been Irish if he hadn't been good enough to play for England.
Well, yeah, this is the frustration. You know, it's not a career move, in my opinion, playing for your national team. It shouldn't be allowed. You don't try a jersey on and, you know, audition in it. I don't agree with that. You know, we're going over old ground here. In terms of their qualities, yes, we don't have similar. And we'd have loved to have seen players of that quality. But likewise, I'd love to have seen players of that quality who believe they're Irish.
100% with Gary.
Yeah, I have to say, like, I defended Declan Rice a lot, but I do find him, you know, singing God Save the Queen in his English jersey a little bit hard to take given his background. But before we wrap up with you, who wins the Premier League and why?
Liverpool win the Premier League because of the strength and depth they've got in their squad and ultimately because of the problems that City have at centre-half. But 6 points, if anyone can bridge it, it is Manchester City and it is ultimately Pep Guardiola. So it's still so much to play for, there's no doubt about it. But I just feel that Liverpool can win ugly games now in a way that they never could before. And I think they will top up the points.
Any interest in going to watch Andy Lee's latest prodigy boxing in Britain in the near future?
Where's he boxing?
He's fighting in Glasgow, November 16th, Paddy. Not sure if you're up that way. Definitely get your team, Gary.
Brilliant. I'd love to see any Irish sport doing well and like that. So best of luck to him.
Well, he's speaking very highly of this kid. He's his first professional fight the weekend before last, and had a 1 minute knockout or something like that.
Yeah, first round. So he's flying the flag if Declan Rice isn't.
Exactly. Brilliant. The long mate continue.
Yeah. Great to talk to you, Gary.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers,
enjoyed
Gary.
It.
You're fairly black and white on the green and white issue.
Yeah, I think it's obviously complex. It's there's identity, all that stuff. It comes into it, doesn't it? I just think, like, if you've been playing at underage, I think, like, the die is cast, and you kind of,
you could you have changed like they did?
No, like, I don't think so. I think, like, once you're kind of there, isn't it? There's a pride there as well, and you fight, like, I don't know. It's hard, you're representing something, you're fighting for something. I don't know. It's so cynical because it's clearly commercial with them. And there is probably like a level of success that they want to achieve, or how far they can go in tournaments and qualifying, playing World Cups or European Championships. But if they're in the Irish team, then our chances of doing that are hugely like intensified. I always want, like, not to go against what Gary Breen said, but Liverpool being favourites for the title, I think this weekend might have let, like, open the door a little bit for City.
Definitely.
Because of the, as the occasion affected them, like, one thing that United beat them in, if it wasn't the game or the spirit, you know, United had probably hungrier to win that match.
Mm.
And if any of the tough, like, Salah was taken out, if any of the other front three get injured along this, like, they don't really have that much in terms of the front. They have Origi, but they don't really have much backup for the front three in terms of the same quality.
No. And their midfield is kind of more functional than amazing. Like, and City are 6
not
points.
Not going to outplay people in the centre of the pack.
No. Now, yeah. They don't. They can't outplay teams. They're all about energy. But City are 6 points behind with vastly superior goal difference already. So it's very much in their hands. I still favour Man City. Because I genuinely don't think Liverpool have 8 wins and a draw. I actually haven't been blown away by them at all this season. I think they've had good patches, but it's time to turn to rugby now. And in the fallout of Ireland's World Cup exit, Matty Williams speaking on Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball, he was looking back at some of Joe Schmidt's decision making in recent years.
But when we needed to score tries against Japan, we couldn't. Now you've got to ask why. And I've listed off the skills that are missing from that team that they did not have. I would also question and say, well, why did we pick Robbie Henshaw at fullback in the first game of this year's Six Nations if we've been planning for 4 years that we needed another fullback? Why not do that on the summer tour down to Australia? Was winning that summer tour so important that we couldn't have left Sexton behind, maybe left Robbie Carney behind and experiment with who could have played at fullback and at 10. Joey Carberry should have started every one of those games, and he didn't. There was more emphasis on beating Australia in a pretty grinding style than let's develop some players, give them some time down there and see how they go. For my part, I would have loved to have seen Joey Carberry play 15 on that tour so that we look now and you can see Australia and New Zealand playing a playmaker at 15 who gets the ball wide. Beauden Barrett at 15 is absolutely dynamic. Joey Carberry with a little bit more space around him could do the same thing. Now, we don't know because we didn't do it a long, long time before the World Cup.
Rory O'Connor should be on the line. Rory?
Hey, Donny.
Have you seen Richard Cooper's Matt Williams?
I have.
Have you seen his Jared Gilroy?
I have. I've no video coming through from your side, so I can't tell if that was Matt Williams or Richard Cooper. It was that good.
Andy Lee, it actually is that good. Joe Schmidt is like
I see him doing
off the charts.
I see him doing Joe.
Has he done Andy Lee yet?
No, I'm not famous enough to get.
You're on about getting into it. You're going to be a movie made of you an hour ago. Now you can't even get a Richard Cooper.
No. But his Jared was pretty good. Joe was pretty good too. Yeah, Joe.
Amazing human being. Yeah. Speaking of amazing human beings, the Irish Independent yesterday, lots of ones. One, this is like a rate the Irish team 1 to 5, starting with 1 for good, but actually it's not. What? Rory, like, do you remember? You remember the days of Daniel McDonald and Oriel Webb when he was like this kind of very aggressively, you know, I suppose controversial young. Journalists wannabe, anyway. We used to give players 0 out of 10 when the Dock played badly. This recalls that. These are amazingly low ratings for the Ireland-New Zealand game. Joe Schmidt won.
Yeah, well, Johnny, you're taking us back to a time that I'd say only about 10 people remember in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Danny would prefer not to remember.
Kind of a strange subculture of online League of Ireland enthusiasts. Yeah. Well, like, on the good days, when Ireland were superb under Joe Schmidt, they received every element of acclaim that they deserved to achieve. And I think when you go out in the biggest game of your World Cup cycle and deliver a performance as abject as the one they gave on Saturday, you have to expect then to be criticised externally. And if players and management are upset by that, maybe they have their priorities wrong. Because like what I think and say probably doesn't really matter and shouldn't really impact on them. I'm just kind of calling it as I see it. They turned up in Tokyo on Saturday night, having ticked almost every box they were supposed to tick along the way. They, like, the high watermark performances of 2018 were so superb, and they were rightly lauded for that. And there's nothing personal in criticising them. It's just the fact that they got to the stage where they were supposed to perform at the highest point of their whole careers, almost, for most of them, and they weren't able to do it. And we're kind of teasing out the reasons behind that at the moment, but even as we do it, it's too late. You know, Joe Schmidt is gone. A lot of those players, some of them will never play for Ireland again. A lot of them will never play in a World Cup again. And we're already kind of turning the page towards what Andy Farrell does next, because at the end of the day, the 2019 World Cup moves on without them, and its four best teams in the world are still here in Tokyo, and Ireland got on a plane this morning and are arriving back this evening.
This is the Irish Independent, page 44 today. Rory in Tokyo. What Farrell must do to put his stamp on Ireland? And I briefly mentioned this with Andy earlier. Will there be, like, I was watching the second half, and Sexton's game obviously kind of fell apart with his kicking, and it was kind of one of those days. You look at Carney as well. Where are these players? Like, where is Andy Farrell going to, what's he going to do with these kind of big hitters who are getting on? Is he going to be like quite ruthless in terms of a cull, or, you know, is he going to be kind of easing in the likes of Carberry and Larmour and so forth? Or what changes is he going to make, or what's he going to do in terms of the ruthlessness of his attitude?
Yeah, these are the kind of big decisions that are awaiting him. And he's never been a head coach before, so he's coming in for the first time as a head coach, having watched Joe Schmidt at close quarters, Warren Gatland at close quarters, Stuart Lancaster at close quarters. I think he worked with Eddie Jones back in the Saracens days. So he's been around top men for a long, long time. He had an unbelievable playing career. You know, he played for England at World Cup in two codes, was a legend at Wigan, the Man of Steel. So, like, his CV as a player, he's an awful lot of experience in this. But now its decisions are his. And he's going to look at a squad of players where he has a kind of contingent of young players who probably some of them did well in this World Cup, others did very little. And he's going to look at his leadership group and a group of players, like Rory Best is the only one who's officially retiring after this World Cup. I don't expect anyone else to go with him. The rest of them are all contracted, but he's going to have to look at the age profile and the fact that, say, Rob Kearney's 37 at the next World Cup, Johnny Sexton's 38, Peter Manny's 34, Conor Murray's 34, Keane Healy's 36, Keith Earls is 35, Dave Kilcoyne's 34, I think John Ryan is somewhere around the same age as well. A lot of those players are the key players who've Joe Schmidt built this team around in the last number of years. And I think what he'll have to do, I haven't spoken to Andy Farrell since Saturday. He didn't do any media before he left. You know, Ireland kept a low profile. Joe was up, I think, at Dublin Airport tonight. I'm sure he'll respond to a couple of the criticisms that have been levelled at him. He'd be straight off a plane, so he'd probably be wrecked. But, Joe was up. But Andy Farrell will at some stage be put up to answer a few questions about his own role, his own take on this New Zealand defeat. But I think what he'll have to do is ease some of those players out the door. Some might go straight away. You know, the Six Nations squad, I think it's 14 weeks until Ireland play their first Six Nations game against Scotland. Life comes at you fast. I mean, that's not a huge amount of time, even considering the World Cup hasn't even ended over here. So I think what he'll do is he'll probably name a number of those experienced players in that squad. He may look to get to the end of the 2020 Six Nations with the best result possible. And then they have two tests in Australia next summer. And he might look to start slowly pivoting towards the World Cup then. He'll have, you know, three or four November games following November. Again, you keep moving it on. You start introducing new blood. You look at someone like Scott Penny at Leinster, Caelan Doris, Craig Casey down in Munster, like the kind of young guys who are 20, 21, 22, who maybe aren't there yet. Ronan Keller lighting it up in the Pro 14 right now. Players who are probably going under the radar while the World Cup is going on. They're the lads that are going to be a bit of an influx of them. But like, he has to be quite revolutionary about what he does, because we've seen what happened in the last 4 years. For all that it ticked all the boxes we thought it had to tick, when it came to it, the players were probably past their best, or at least very much out of form. And Joe Schmidt kept picking them regardless of that. And that was one of the key mistakes that Schmidt made, unfortunately, at this World Cup.
Roy, like, you just talked about key mistake. You think Joe Schmidt announced that he was going to leave the job before the World Cup. Do you think that's a mistake in hindsight now? Do you think that affected the performance or the team in any way?
I mean, I think it can't be discounted as a factor. I probably dismissed it out of hand myself at the time. Steve Hansen is gone at the end of this World Cup, and that doesn't seem to have affected the All Blacks. Him and Ian Foster, his assistant, who's probably going to take over, have revolutionised the way that team have played in the last 9-10 months, and the players have bought in. Warren Gatland's gone as well. I know Wales weren't brilliant at the weekend, but they're still in the World Cup semi-final, and his players still appear to be playing for him in the same way. And I'm not saying the players stop playing for Joe, but I do think that maybe there was a bit of slippage behind the scenes in the fact that he demanded, like, it was such a demanding regime. It was such a committed regime. It required 100% focus at every moment of every time. And he kind of ruled by fear. And I wonder if the fear factor just slipped that little bit, like 0.5% or 1%. And even the fact that he said they started looking at a semi-final, and maybe like all the whole thing was rooted in a game, a moment by moment focus. I mean, they reviewed every training session, as a video analysis session, every mistake was scrutinized, and the players looked like they were playing with fear at the weekend of that. They weren't empowered. So I'm probably even contradicting myself in this answer, but like, I think there's a number of different factors, and that has to be one of them. But the man who's taken over was there in the room as well. So like, the players weren't and at the same time, like, if that is an excuse, it's not a great one, because the players, most of them know that this is the best opportunity to win a World Cup or to at least get past the quarterfinal for the first time. So what does the coach's situation really have to do with anything? I think you can't dismiss it as a factor, but I think there's probably other factors, a myriad of other ones that all built into just that slippage that we've seen. And I think like the confidence going after the England games probably is one of the biggest ones.
Yeah, and how tainted is his legacy? Because granted, okay, they beat the Kiwis twice. Now, in light of last Saturday, that seemed like the dinner of last year that like is no good to you now. But also the fact that Joe Schmidt said before the World Cup that, rugby's kind of evolving pretty much quite notably every 6 months. Yet to me, there seems to be absolutely no evolution, little or no evolution from last November, before Ireland were effectively figured out by other teams, up until when they faced New Zealand on Saturday. And I thought Rory in the national anthem, you could see like Rory Best to me looked like a guy who was actually afraid of what was to come, as to some of the Ireland players. To me, there was very little evolution in Joe Schmidt in terms of how to, now I don't know enough about it to say that you can do this in the space of even a year, but that Irish team,
well, the
team,
All Blacks did it.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly,
like the All Blacks did it. The Irish, so it is possible.
The Irish team have been very quickly figured out, and he didn't seem to have any answer.
Look, there's an argument that Ireland had punched above their weight throughout Joe Schmidt's time in charge, and eventually it came back, that everyone caught up with them, and once they got to the top of the tree and everyone analysed them, that basically they came back to the mean, and maybe top eight in the world is where Ireland are at. But this team convinced us to think that that was not the case, that they were amongst the best teams in the world, and they convinced us through their own performances. It wasn't bluster. Look, I was at Eddie Jones' press conference earlier that, England talk a good game. Joe never was really into that. It was all about what happens on the pitch. Judge us on what happens on the pitch, and you're only as good as your last game. You're only as good as your last performance. I think his legacy will go down. He is Ireland's greatest coach. His results over the his win ratio, his win-loss ratio is better than any of his rivals, and his silverware collected, between his time at Leinster, he's definitely Leinster's greatest coach, and his Leinster legacy is completely unbesmirched by this. It's a separate thing. He came into Ireland, he won 2 Six Nations with a very good team. Then he kind of replenished after O'Connell and O'Driscoll left. And he kept Ireland at the top of the tree for so long. And unfortunately, the reality of being in Japan and the reality of being at a World Cup is that ultimately nearly all that matters is what happens in this 5 or 6 week cycle. Because this is when every team is at their best. And when everyone was at their best and there was no one looking beyond tournaments and all those things taken out of it, Ireland didn't deliver performance. And at the end of the day, Ireland's record defeats at World Cups have come in quarterfinals coached by Joe Schmidt. He broke his team broke their own record against New Zealand on Saturday. And I think that will besmirch his legacy. I'm not saying his legacy is, like, he's improved players, he's changed the way Ireland has thought about rugby. He's left a generation of coaches who all will look at him as an example of what to do and probably a little bit of what not to do. But I mean, I think the positive probably outweighs the negative on that front. But ultimately, no coach ever had a better condition, had better conditions to succeed at this tournament. You know, they play like the RFU have implemented all the findings that were found in the last two tournament reviews. Players have moved eggs. A lot of eggs have been broken to try and make this particular omelet. You know, I mean, the provinces aren't happy with the amount of management that goes on of their players. They don't talk about it publicly much since Matt O'Connor got sacked after Joe Schmidt did a press conference to call him out on his own record. You know, that was the kind of power that Joe Schmidt had. Mm. Players were moved. Joe Carby, Jordy Murphy, you know, the Leinster would argue that their chances of retaining the European Cup last year were basically weakened in the national interest because their players were moved on by choice, but they certainly encouraged to move on. So look, no one ever came in with better conditions. The barriers to entry were removed from them, and at the end of the day, having been a top team coming into the tournament, the world's number one team coming into this tournament, having done everything they did in 2018, the drop off is very, very, very much significant. And I think while it doesn't ruin his legacy, it certainly undermines it.
Did you watch Japan, South Africa?
I saw bits of it, yeah, but obviously watched the Ireland match and yeah, how they played. And
you know, it's a fairly crude parallel to make with our football team, Rory. But like, I watched pretty much most of the Japan South Africa game. I was glued to the first half, and granted, it's slightly patronising because it's like Japan, you know, they're the hosts and great atmosphere and all that. But their handling of the ball and their audacity to play the ball to go wide to totally different set plays to what Ireland do, and you compare that to the relative snooze fest that Ireland were for most of this tournament and most of this year, being honest. Like, do we need to look at, I know Liam Toland had a piece in the Times yesterday, he's literally speaking about changing the way we coach kids at under 12, but do we need to look at our philosophy in terms of rugby? Because, you know, we've these purportedly world class wingers who don't get a try in the entire bloody tournament, and they're not getting so much the ball, but it just seems to be like that once our forward play broke down or was kind of figured out, we didn't seem to have any actual proper expanse of rugby. And is this something that is Andy Farrell even the man to change this, given that his own background isn't exactly you know, in tune with what I'm talking about here? Do we bring in Joey Carberry at out half? What do we do to make us actually even just play better attractive rugby? Because I didn't see much of that in this World Cup.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, I think Japan, a little bit like Leicester City when they won the Premier League a couple of years ago, they made everyone else look bad because they were doing things that everyone said, you know, was basically nigh on impossible. In the end, they ran aground against a more powerful team. But unlike Ireland, and really, like, of all the eight teams who played in the quarterfinal, Ireland were probably the most disappointing in terms of not firing any sort of a shot. Japan stuck true to the way they play, tried to beat South Africa's rush defence with their passing, succeeded at times, but just couldn't finish the job. And like, in the end, South Africa could have won by a lot more. But Japan went out in the manner, you know, in an honourable way, I suppose. You know, they stayed true to what they do. They kept fighting to the end, and this tournament will always be remembered fondly by the Japanese players, coaches, you know, and fans. They're a whole new generation of fans, and what they do with that is one of the big questions coming out of this tournament in the longer term. From an Irish point of view, you're watching the way they played. You watch the way Australia threw a few blows at England, the way everyone else attacked, and you wonder how they are not figure out a way of breaking teams down better when throughout the Six Nations this year it looked very, very clear that the kind of going through them was never going to work anymore. That the way Ireland beat teams during the 2018 Six Nations with that relentless phase play, you know, getting up to 20, 30 phases, grounding teams down, winning collisions, you know, going in with latch plays, James Ryan, Dan Levy, that wasn't going to work anymore. And we could say that there wasn't enough time to reinvent, but in the same time period, New Zealand, with a much more talented group of players and more informed players coming through, were able to go out and go, hang on, right, this is what we need to do. There's certain things that Schmidt will look back on with regret, but there's also little bits of circumstance that deprived them of certain options, like Joey Carberry getting injured during the Six Nations when Johnny Sexton wasn't playing well. So we never got to see how Carberry would have put pressure on when he got injured in Murrayfield that time. Even Jack Conan, I have a feeling that they were moving towards Jack Conan as their number 8 for the knockouts, and I'm not saying they would have beaten the All Blacks necessarily if Conan had started, but if you can move CJ Standard to 6 and get more out of Jack Conan's running game, you might get something more. But in terms of Andy Farrell coming in then, like his track record, we don't really know what his philosophy is going to be, because he's always been part of someone else's regime. He was responsible in large part for the 2015 England attack, which is probably one of the better parts of their game in the build-up, but then didn't deliver it at the tournament itself because they picked Burgess and he went for the big man in the midfield and everything fell apart from there. He's got Mike Catt in with him. You know, Mike Catt's CV wouldn't be the greatest as a coach, but he's well regarded within coaching circles without being anyone really knowing exactly what he's going to bring to the table. Like, they're not going for a kind of a New Zealand guru of the Tony Brown as the guy behind Japan's attack. You'd love to see them going after someone like that who can just come in and reinvent the way Ireland play. Now, Stephen Larkham's down in Munster. He'll improve the way they're doing it. Leinster have a very high-skilled approach, or at least when Lancaster first came in, they keep them all alive really well. Connacht play great rugby. So there is people working behind the scenes in the provinces. You know, Ireland were probably the most conservative, about maybe apart from Munster, of the five teams in Irish professional rugby last year. And if you throw the under-20s into that, you could still probably put the senior team into that. Schmidt always complained that he didn't have enough time to implement anything very revolutionary, that they had to stick to the basics. So Farrell's working under the same constraints, largely with the same players. You know, Carberry's a real good ball player. Larmer, like the way he played against New Zealand when he was on, the game was over, but you're going, oh, how was this guy's form not rewarded? He's the one player who made them think on their feet. He'll come in. He's a guaranteed starter. Get Stockdale's confidence back up. Henshaw and Ringrose are both very good attackers. There are high skilled players in that team. I think what Farrell needs to do maybe is lighten the psychological load on them by not calling out every mistake in training, and maybe encouraging them to make mistakes so that when it comes to, they're not afraid to take risks.
Absolutely.
But look, you're talking about kind of all sorts of, like there's a massive big review that's going to have to be done now. I don't think they're going to go out and do a Genesis report as such like they did in 07, but I think Farrell, like from the moment that looming camera shot towards the end of the game, when that haunted look on Schmidt's face, Farrell was just hooked in beside him. What was going through his mind? Because he knows he's starting on the back foot now, unfortunately, because, you know, he's the defence coach and his team conceded 7 tries in the final game. A lot of them are down to their own errors in attack, but still,
having said that,
that's not a great place to start on.
He's almost better starting now than starting, we'll say, this time last year, where, like, at least he's taken over from a little bit of a mess as opposed to when we were basically on a complete high last year. I want to just finally call you, though, and I think this is very interesting. You slightly hedge your bets here, but you're also quite forthright. The end is nigh for Johnny Sexton. So how long does Johnny Sexton have left? I was watching that game, and I was just like, the kick when we were, what was it, 9-0 down, like, I mean, that was, it was almost exactly perfect, yet it cost us. And then that horrible kick in the second half, and just like, Sexton just wants the ground to swallow him up here. Speaks before the game about, you guys are going to be saying, you know, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on me, Carberry should be coming in, yada yada, but like, who starts out half in our first Six Nations game?
I think Johnny Sexton probably has a role to play in the next 2 years. He's contracted until 2021. He wants to play in the Lions Tour. I think on current form, there's absolutely no chance that he'd be considered for that. Gatland, you know, tried to move on from him even in the last Lions Tour, and he played his way back into form. He's 34 now. I think his role probably is to help Joey Carberry become the next number 10, but he won't like that.
Johnny Sexton is a competitor. Yeah, that's not his DNA,
but maybe by doing that with Carberry, Andy Farrell will bring the best out in Sexton, because Sexton seems to like having a chip on his shoulder about things, and maybe, you know, being told that he's finished by Andy Farrell might be the one thing that brings the best out of him, and Ireland might get some value out of him for the next 2 years. But, you know, he's going to be 38 at the next World Cup. I know he's talked about the Tom Brady stuff, but his body clearly hasn't been playing ball with him. You know, he was injured at the start of this tournament. He was very good through the tournament. In the end, I mean, I thought, you know, the Scotland performance, he was kind of quiet, but he was kind of the one they rallied around in the Russia-Samoa games when things were going bad. They were better. Up until the semi-final or the quarter-final, they were better with him on the pitch than they were without him. Carberry's injury record isn't great. They just really need to get him a run of time in there. You know, does Ross Byrne come into the equation now? Jack Hardy had a good World Cup, but, you know, they need more time with him as well. It's very hard. I'm not going to sit here and finish Johnny Sexton off. His career is probably too great for that. I mean, he still has a role to play. There's talk that he will be a great coach in the future. Does he take on that sort of mantle as kind of almost a half player, half coach? I don't know if there's room for that in the setup. I think everything's on the table at the moment. But I do think that Farrell will have to back a new core of players to move this thing forward.
Yeah.
And I think players who are going to be 37, 38 at the next World Cup, well, they'll have a role to play in the first half of the World Cup cycle, probably won't have a role to play as that cycle goes on. And Sexton is one of those, and that reality comes around to all players. And it's unfortunate. He's had a great career. I'm not finishing off right now, but I think, you know, Joey Carberry is probably going to be Ireland's out half in 2023 in France, and the team, we need to get used to that fact.
We're going to have to say goodbye to you. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it's very hard for these journalists to go away for, what are you away for, like 6 or 7 weeks?
I have no idea. I think this is week 6.
Any message for your lovely, long-suffering wife, Siobhan, kind of labouring here in Dublin in your absence?
The one thing I know about my wife is that she won't be listening to me on the radio, so it's fine. She came out for a few days last week, so, or the week before, so I'm doing okay, Johnny. I'm well used to these tours, and like people listening back home are not going to think that I'm having a hard time being out here at a World Cup in Japan. It's been a class experience, and it's just a pity Ireland aren't, like, I would love to cover Ireland in a World Cup semi-final and a final. Unfortunately, I'm going to be at England, New Zealand and Wales and South Africa this weekend in Yokohama. And while I really enjoy being at that level of rugby live up front, being there 4 years ago was brilliant. I cover the Irish team through, you know, all the time. I'd love to have been able to cover them in those two games. Unfortunately, that wasn't to be this time around. In 4 years' time, we'll see if Andy Farrell can get them there.
You just want to come home and watch Bowes.
I won't be able to. To be finished. I'll be watching videos of Friday night on my phone all weekend to cheer me up. You know,
Siobhan may not have been listening anyway, but that was Rory O'Connor.
Cheers, Johnny.
Top man, Woods.
Good luck. See you later.
Thanks for coming in, Andy.
Oh yeah.
What are we looking forward to? Just to reiterate, in the near future, from your stable.
Oh, just get the lads fighting again. Keep them busy now. And Jason Quigley's fighting December 5th in California. He's fighting a Mexican opponent, tough guy, and he's looking to rebuild, get back to winning ways, and then push on next year back into contention for a title. But one of the things that, just to go back to the rugby, like Schmidt had mentioned, like the on-field leaders, you mentioned Roy Best, Peter O'Mahony and Johnny Sexton. I think Sexton, when he did play, the performance, albeit against, not against the All Blacks, but look at that Samoa and Russia game, the team was remarkably improved.
But his stats are off the charts when he's not playing.
And what he's done so far, like, there is a tendency to go over the top with player. You know what I mean? I do think the level of analysis and team meetings probably, and the fear that brings, you know, but from playing, I think they look like a team playing with fear, paralysed by fear, but I think Rory's been very consistently good over the World Cup, hasn't he? In terms of his analysis and breaking down the games and really surmising what people are thinking.
Yeah, I think in fairness, his ratings are fairly cutting, but I'm really looking forward to transition now, just to see how Farrell will change things up. Partly because he was part of that legacy, good and bad, and he's also like a defensive coach. So we need to start playing a bit more attractive rugby, to my mind.
I think everyone was, even though they were the neutral, the home favourites, but just the way they played, everyone was. We're supporting Japan.
They're handling, even the forwards. Like, and I think we need to see that. But what are you up to for the rest of the week?
Training, lads. Being here for Off the Brawl.
Off the Brawl, yeah?
Yeah, it's our boxing show. And that's about it.
Thanks for coming in.
Cheers, Johnny. Thanks.
And that was Andy Lee. He obviously has plenty to look forward to in terms of his coaching career with the two guys. And we'll be back in a few minutes with the story of Charlie Gallagher. That's the GAA's lost icon. And that's well worth listening to. But firstly, Leaders Crescent with Stuart Lancaster is back with Off the Ball this week for episode 2 of the second series. I'd highly recommend this. If you missed any of last week's brilliant sit-down interview with Stuart, you can watch it all back on offtheball.com. This week, Munster and Ireland legend Ron Nogara joins Ger and Stuart from New Zealand, where he was coaching with the Crusaders at the time it was recorded, and some brilliant insight into his career coming your way, including this clip about his first experience in the Irish and British lines. The first episode is live at 1 p.m. today across Off the Ball and OTB Sports Radio.
At the Lions, it was interesting just to see the difference in guys from different nations, and Graham Henry in 2001, and he showed me leadership straight between the eyes, and I thought it was a great comment. I got the day of the last test in Sydney in 2001. I'd been going well on the kind of midweek team, and Johnny Wilkinson was obviously the starter. Neil Jenkins was the other option, and Neil Jenkins wasn't basically far off a trip to Lourdes. His two knees were the size of balloons. He could barely walk. the team was announced, and number 21, Neil Jenkins, and I was kind of going, oh no, this couldn't last. You know, he literally couldn't train. And I remember Henry said to me, he just goes, you know, Raj, he goes, if there's a field goal, 2 minutes to go from 45 minutes, I'm backing this guy to kick it. And at the moment, you're kind of going, no, I don't see that. But with the benefit of hindsight, you go, yeah, absolutely proven. In those kind of high-stakes games, I think that was a moment of leadership from him, because Jenkins does exactly what it says in the team. He kicks goals all his career from 45 metres. At that stage, I was a complete rookie. I wouldn't have been in that category. So I think, you know, I mean, you could toss it out maybe. Well, what happens if he got injured? If Johnny got injured after 10 minutes, then it would have been an interesting scenario. But in terms of, it was a different game back then. Obviously, penalties were far more prominent in winning games than probably scoring tries were. So yeah. I think that was an example of it.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
All right, this morning on OTB AM, we're looking at a new sports book, Charlie, the story of Charlie Gallagher, the GAA's lost icon. I'm delighted to say that Paul Fitzpatrick, sports writer with the Anglo-Celt, is with us in the studio this morning. Paul, how are you?
Not too bad, Tommy.
Paul, this book, Charlie, right, we're going to start off, we're going to let people know you're a Cavan man. So when I started reading this, Charlie Gallagher, the story of Charlie, a footballer in the 50s and the 60s, I was asking myself, how did I not know who Charlie Gallagher was? And I've asked a couple of people since, and they didn't know. And it's striking that on the front page, now it is a striking image of Charlie Gallagher there, it's striking on the front page and in the title of the book, he's called the GAA's lost icon. How is he lost? Like, for you, as a Cavan boy growing up, did you know all about Charlie Gallagher?
Yeah, I've heard about him. So I would have heard about him from my grandfather who followed Cavan in the 60s. And this story is typical of Cavan supporters, because the last match my granddad ever went to was the 1969 Ulster final. And Charlie retired after that. And I asked him, why did you stop following Cavan in 69? And he said, well, Charlie retired. And he said, it wasn't the same. It's like, it's hard to describe what a hero he was in the 1960s in small town Ireland. Like, I said to someone recently that Charlie in his heyday was bigger in we'll say small town Cavan than the likes of Ronaldo or Messi is now. And I know that sounds foolish to say that, but you weren't as exposed to these sort of, you know, demigods as you are now. You didn't have all that TV coverage and all that. And here was this absolute icon walking amongst you, you know, the word made flesh. And we'll say in 1984, the GAA named their team of the century. Charlie didn't win in All-Ireland, but talking to people around that time, a lot of them said if Charlie had got an All-Ireland medal, he would have been on the team of the century. On the same night, the GAA named the greatest team ever to win an All-Ireland. Like, Charlie was on that in 1984. So that was his status. But over the years, he sort of, I don't know, his reputation, probably from not winning an All-Ireland, he probably doesn't have the status that he should have in terms of an icon of the game. Now, I know he was, the Independent did the 125 greatest players a few years ago for the 125 of the GAA, and he was in it at number 94. So, like, when you consider the thousands of great players, he's still pretty high, but he probably should have been higher.
His status is there, and he's really important. His brother Brian, we'll get into his family in a few minutes, and we'll get into the fact that he's compared to George Best, the George Best of Gaelic football, and that's a very striking comparison. We'll get into some of the off-field issues later on, but on the field, what type of footballer was Charlie Gallagher?
Yeah, well, there's a chapter in the book called The Making of a Marksman, and where I talk about it at length, because his style was something unique. And from talking to his teammates and opponents and stuff like that for interviews, a lot of them talked about his style. He was extremely quick. He was an absolute rocket off the mark. Most players I spoke to said he was the quickest player they had ever witnessed. He wasn't a man for the rough stuff. Yeah. And people would say that with a chuckle, because Charlie, some people would say maybe he was a bit windy. I don't know if he was windy, but he you have to imagine that the full back line in the 60s was shark infested waters. Like, they just wanted to stop a man from playing, and got away with it back then. So Charlie would have come in for a lot of rough treatment. His balance was a big thing. He was known for, he was almost airborne when he gathered possession. So if he got a hit, you couldn't knock him. He almost went up instead of going down. And then he was a free taker. He regularly topped the scoring charts. Almost every year in the 1960s, the Sunday Independent used to keep a list of the top scorers every week. Okay. And almost every year in the 60s, he's in the top three, and he topped it on three occasions. There was one year he actually scored more than the highest scorer in Hurling, which was Eddie Kerr that year. So, like, he was an absolute icon. Ray Carlin, who was probably the best known Cavan player of that era, he says that Charlie would never score ordinary points. He always scored spectacular points.
Really?
And he was known for these huge, big, high points that would bend in. And then when he would score a point, see, the biggest thing he had was his charisma. So when he would score a point, he'd walk out to Ray Carlin and one of his teammates and he'd go, "What do you think of that?" You know, and this could be a big game in Croke Park. He had this sort of charisma. So I interviewed Seamus Hoare, who was a Ulster Railway Cup player, Donegal man, a goalkeeper in the 60s, and was friendly with Charlie. And the way he described him was, he said he was the sort of man that comes along once in a lifetime, because he had the ultimate combination of incredible skill, and he had the looks. Obviously, you can see the photographs of him in the book. Like, he was a very handsome man. That's where the George Best comparison came in as well.
In all the team photos, he jumps out.
Yeah, he does.
He jumps out in all the team photos that are in the book.
Yeah, he does. And the funny thing was, in team photos, he was often in the front and centre, the front row. He just had that.
He's got the hair. He's got the hairstyle. He's got the socks put. You know, he knows he's there to put on a show.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a showman, and he was immaculately turned out, as you say. You know, he had it all. And as you alluded to there, he had a serious off the field problem in later years with alcoholism as well. Which again, the comparison with George Best is relevant there.
I was kind of fascinated by the building of an icon and how an icon can be created back in the 50s and 60s, because like when you make the George Best comparison, it is striking, and you know it can be an easy one to make as well for someone who's, you know, flashy on the field and so perhaps devastating off it at times. But it's not it's a complicated story. Like, you've woven it with tales of how Ulster changed at that time and how that affected football in the county and how important football was to society at that time. Like, can we go back to when Charlie was growing up? He grew up in Cute Hill, and he had brothers who played football. Did his parents, was his father involved in football?
There's actually a chapter which gives the backstory of the family. So his father was a doctor. He came from Lewisburg in Mayo, and so there's a whole story there. But basically, he was set up to go into the priesthood. This is back in the 1917, 18, around that time. His mother wants him to go into the priesthood. He decided he would do that. He went to Dublin for 6 weeks to study in a seminary and didn't like it and went home. And the story is that his mother, this is Charlie's dad now, his mother said she didn't want any more to do with him because he didn't become a priest. She basically banished him. He went over and lived across the road and lived with his aunt, and she paid for him to go to study to become a doctor. So Charlie's father was a doctor, and he settled in Cavan after a few years, met Charlie's mother, and they had 7 children. Charlie was born on Christmas Day in 1937. So again, every little thing you can think of, you know, if you weren't going to be a superstar, what day would you be born? Like, it's Christmas Day. It's classic of Charlie. But so he grew up, so they would have had a few quid. He wouldn't have grown up in poverty in Cavan in the 40s. And then he went to study in St. Pat's College in Cavan, which was the kind of leading football academy in Ulster at the time. But the very interesting thing, so when Charlie was a minor, he was better known than a lot of senior intercounty players. And I have quotes in the book from people saying that. You know, he was known as this up-and-coming superstar. So Cavan won 5 All-Irelands in 19 years up until 52. 55, they came back and they won the Ulster title. Brian Gallagher, who was Charlie's brother, was on that team. And they lost to Kerry in a replay in the All-Ireland semi-final. So their stock was still very high. And that year, Charlie was 17 and had played with the minors. And there was a big outcry in the county to get him into the senior team. Anyway, they didn't bring him in until that November for the National League. And from that point on, from Charlie made his debut, Cavan didn't win an Ulster title for 7 years. And there had never been a famine like it in Cavan. And people thought this was the end of the world in Cavan, because football was really all they had. And immigration was very high. And in rural Cavan, which is a very rural county then and now, you know, with the football team was going so bad. Cavan, up until 1946, Cavan had never trained for an Ulster final. It was just taken as a given. Cavan would win Ulster, and then he would train for an All-Ireland semi-final. But Cavan started to lose. And, you know, you can actually plot, people often ask, why did Cavan decline so badly? But you can actually trace it back to that period.
You can see it in the book, yeah.
Yeah, from 55 to 62, because the Northern team started to rise up in that period. So I mentioned there's a famous photograph from 1956 where Tyrone won the first Ulster title, and there's a Tyrone forward running out and he's wagging his finger at the crowd like that, and he just scored a goal, and the Cavan goalkeeper Seamus Morris is on the ground. Tyrone hammered Cavan in the Ulster final in 1956, which was absolutely a monumental shock. In 58, Derry came and won their first Ulster title, and like, Derry hadn't even established a county board until the 30s, so they were arriving. And then in 59, to make things worse for Cavan, Down came, hammered Cavan in the Ulster final. 60, Down got the All-Ireland. 61, Down got the All-Ireland again. So by that stage, Cavan, were struggling to cope with all these blows that were taken from everywhere. Yeah. And I'd say Charlie didn't know what to expect because he came in with almost a birthright to win Ulster titles. And here he was, 24, 25, and hadn't won anything.
And you mentioned, he was a superstar at minor. And when you mentioned that, how he was talked about at minor more than some senior players, you think about David Clifford and Shaunie O'Shea. But I remember watching Clifford, and you get clips on Twitter or YouTube. And that's how word of mouth spreads nowadays. It's easy, it's quick, nothing's private, everything goes really quickly. How were people hearing about Charlie Gallagher back then?
Yeah, I suppose they were hearing it on the grapevine and maybe seeing match reports. And the point, he's got a catchy name, Charlie Gallagher is sort of a catchy name, there's an assonance to it. And I think that he just caught the imagination. So if you look at, say, team sheets with minor teams back in the 50s, I looked up, Charlie was playing for the Cavan Miners when he was 15, and every player would get their initials. You'd have, Pete Fitzpatrick, T. Rooney, whatever it was. Mm. And it would come to Charlie, and it was Charlie Gallagher. He got his full name because Charlie was marked out as something special. So obviously then, in 62, Cavan finally made a breakthrough, won Ulster, and they went on and won four Ulster titles in the 60s, Charlie as captain for two of them. But when you're tracing back to the decline of Cavan, you can trace it back to that era.
Let's stay on that for a moment, because it wasn't just football. It wasn't just Tyrone decided to start training. Ulster changed around that time. And when you're reading the book, you can just tell how Ulster football awoke. You think back to the Gaelic games then, and perhaps it was a lazy thought of mine, but I'd have thought it was more country people playing. But it was a game for professionals and educated people. And people in Ulster started to become more educated back then.
Yeah, completely. And Paul Rouse is very good on this topic. I spoke to Paul when I was researching this, and he gave me a load of information on this sort of thing. So the phrase he used was ratio of the soil. There's this image, as you said, country, rural counties were turning out county teams full of farmers and things like that. That was never the case. I have a quote in the book from Jim McDonald, great Cavan player of that era, and he says, there was very few farmers. And if you look even at the Cavan team that won in the polo grounds, you had dentists and army officers and future Taoiseach there, and that followed right through. Charlie was a dentist in the 60s. You would have had lots of professionals, doctors, and you had a surgeon playing in goals, this sort of thing. Farmers were too busy. They hadn't time to go and play football back then. So, how things changed in the north then was post-World War II, a new Labour government came in the UK. And as I said, Paul Rouse is an expert on this. Somebody passed on really what Paul has informed me, but Clement Attlee was Prime Minister. And I suppose from the horrors of war and all of that, there was sort of a move to the left, and he introduced the NHS and the welfare state and all that, and they brought in free secondary education. So in 1947, you had the Free Education Act in Northern Ireland, which suddenly opened up second level education to a whole generation of nationalists who had never got it, who were playing Gaelic games. So they went into schools, and suddenly they were getting exposed to a good level of coaching. And that was 47. If you take lads going in there at 11 or 12 in 47, in 1956, Tyrone won their first Ulster title with a 19-year-old captain, Jody O'Neill. So there's a direct correlation there. And again, 58 Derry, 59 Down. They had been competing in the Ulster Junior Championship at times before that. So, Cavan, maybe we talk about the glorious history of Cavan. We probably had it all to ourselves in Ulster up to that point, up until the 50s.
It does seem like that.
Yeah, no, we have to be honest here. Yeah.
It's amazing when you look at how obvious the link is to the changes that happened in society at that time and how it developed those counties. Like, that great Down team then came along, and they're a major part of this book in the early 60s because they're a thorn in Cavan's side, and the tables are just turned from 55 to 65 completely.
Yeah, and Cavan were obsessed with beating Down. By the time 62 came around, Down had been hammering Cavan, not just beating them, but there was one game, I think it was the 1959 Ulster final, where they beat Cavan something like 215 to 7 points, and the Down supporters actually climbed up the goalposts. They were just delirious. And there's a quote from Maurice Hayes where he always said that Cavan were like a dragon lying in the path of every Ulster county. If you could, your summer was defined by, how much Cavan would beat you by. But once they got over Cavan, they realised they could go on and win all Ireland. So then the 60s team, Cavan rose again with Charlie and his teammates in the 60s. And that kind of lasted 7 or 8 years. Cavan and Down shared Ulster between them in the 60s. Cavan won 4 and Down won 6, but Cavan beat Down in four Ulster finals, two of them when they were All-Ireland champions, but Cavan never got their All-Ireland, so
couldn't get over it.
I've read Martin Brownie before talking about the Cavan team in the 60s, and he said it's commonly acknowledged it's an absolute mystery how they never won an All-Ireland. At 67, I think Charlie was captain, that was the one that got away. They lost to Cork in the All-Ireland semi-final, and in the book there's quotes from players saying they think 67 was their best team and just didn't happen.
Yeah, it's amazing looking back on it. And then 69 as well, we'll come back to that maybe before we finish. There was a probably a bit of consternation about how they let that All-Ireland semi-final slip as well. The book opens with a story about Wembley and Cavan going over to play in Wembley. And just reading it, there's a real mystique and kind of magic about these JFK Memorial Games and the teams have been selected to go over there. Like, what did you think reading back on all those games and these guys going over to London and New York for the first time? Like, it was a major thing for lads from the country to be going over and playing Gaelic games over there.
Oh, absolutely. Like, the other point that I forgot to make there was about the emigration of Cavan. So Cavan was one of the worst hit counties for emigration, but in these places outside the county, you had thousands of Cavan people there. Literally thousands of Cavan people, would say, in London, and they came from Coventry and Birmingham and everywhere, and they all floated into the capital when Cavan got to Wembley to play. So Charlie captained Cavan to win two Wembley tournaments. Those games were screened live on RTE. In 66, they beat Sligo, and that game was played 6 weeks after the World Cup final in 1966 in the same stadium.
In Wembley, yeah.
Yeah, there's a quote there from Tony Morris, who was on the team. He says that they were used to togging out at the back of a ditch, and here they were in these almost, he described it as like gold-plated bats and stuff like that. You know, the stuff that Bobby Moore and Pelle and all these fellas had experienced. So, like, it was absolutely out of this world. In 67, Cavan beat Galway in the final, and like, they were 3 in a row All-Ireland winners. Cavan beat them by a point, Charlie with the winning point. And there's an iconic photograph in the book of Charlie going up to receive the cup in the Royal Box. It's probably the most famous picture of him, and you can see, like, he looks like a modern day person. He's so well groomed and his teeth are perfect, and you know, people in the 60s look different, but yeah. he looked like someone we expect to see now.
Yeah. It's a fantastic story, and like, it's when you're reading it, you're just like, how do I not know who this is? How have I not heard of this man? He was such a major figure in Gaelic games back then, and it struck me reading it as well that it's such a pity we don't have an absolute record of the top scorers in Gaelic games, that we can't look back and say, well, Charlie Gallagher is number 54 or 46. And
it's a shame. And like, at one point in the 60s, it was reckoned that Charlie was the highest scorer of all time at one point in the 60s, but records were sketchy. I thought you were going to say that we don't have footage, because unfortunately there's no footage of Charlie. Bar one of those games in Wembley, there's some amateur footage.
Is there no archive footage of Charlie Gallagher?
No, nobody can find any footage of Charlie, because he didn't play in an All-Ireland final, and they're just... footage hasn't shown up.
It's a pity.
Even his family haven't seen footage of him playing. But there is this amateur footage from Wembley, and it's amazing. There's actually a streaker who runs on the pitch at one stage. So, mad stuff.
One of my favourite stories in the book, and perhaps it's because I'm just over the Cavan border in Meath, but it was Charlie. He was seen as probably, he wasn't a great trainer, say. And you mentioned earlier on that he could have been seen as being a bit flashy, maybe, and he was a bit soft, perhaps. But in terms of free taking and perfecting the craft, like, I've heard Shawnee Shea talking about how much hours he puts into practicing frees. Gallagher, there's a story of Charlie Gallagher practicing frees in Breffni Park, and he'd only dropped the ball a certain length over the bar because he was afraid that the young lads he had with him would get into danger around the river.
That's right, yeah.
And Shawnee Boylan comes up as well.
Yeah, so Sean, when Charlie was in UCD, there was a fella called Jim McCabe. Go back to what we were saying about professionals. This guy called Jim McCabe, who played with the Cavan team in 1952. He went in to teach him, but he actually ended up something like chief financial officer in the World Bank based in Paris. And he was a Cavan man. He was from Mullaghorn, I think. But he's still alive, actually, in Sligo. But at this time, Jim McCabe was teaching. And he was teaching in Clogher Road, which is like a technical college over near Crumlin somewhere. And Charlie was in UCD. So Charlie used to go and practice his frees with Jim McCabe. On a Wednesday, Jim McCabe would bring the students down for football and hurling practice. And one of them was a young Sean Boylan, who had gone to Belvedere, but he was doing a year or two in this after he finished. And he used to go down, and his job was to catch the ball and give it back to Charlie. And I rang him up, and he was delighted to chat about it. Mm. But he always said that he used to tell the Meath players, like O'Rourke and all those great players on the Meath teams, about the importance of making the most of the time you have to practice. So he said Charlie would come along, and if he was practicing frees for an hour, you know, it was an intense hour, and he would get it right. And that's why he became, he was the greatest free taker of his era.
We mentioned how it's as much about the GAA and society and ulster at the time. We might jump ahead to the end of Cavan football for Charlie Gallagher, because it was a sad enough end. But before we kind of come to his retirement and stuff, he lived in Derry. He had a dental practice in Derry, so he was in Derry in the 70s. So, like, when you, it's such a shame that his life ended the way perhaps it did, and you know, the comparisons to George Best start there with the alcoholism off the field. Mm. It was tough for him after he finished football. He found it difficult.
Yeah, see, Charlie was a man who never really grew up. A lot of people have used that that expression to describe Charlie. So he was like a young fella who loved the crack. He was childlike and he'd be enthusiastic about things. And I was trying to figure out, you know, where this alcoholism came from with Charlie. Talking to his family, who were unbelievable help with the book. You know, the theory that I came up with, was that he was, first of all, Derry was a soccer town. It wasn't a big Gaelic town. And so Charlie was sort of removed from the source of his celebrity straight away. He might as well, I won't say he might as well have been out of the country, but Derry wasn't a big Gaelic town. He wasn't meeting Gaelic football people on the street every day like he would have been. So for a man like Charlie, who loved the limelight and the celebrity, that was probably a shock to the system. Then he was running a business. Then he had stopped playing and he maybe had got out of shape. He wasn't used to this routine. And addicts need routine. And he had lost that. He wasn't getting in his car driving to Goodhill. And he drove a sports car, that was the other thing as well. But he wasn't getting in his car driving to Goodhill or Cavan to train. That was gone as well. He had three children, he had a wife. So all these things happened in a short space of time. Plus, he was basically living in a war zone. You know, where his surgery was in Clarendon Street, like the CS gas would be wafting up the street, you know, it'd be coming in the windows. It was that close to the areas where this real conflict was happening. And there's stories in the book about his wife Maureen's car being hijacked. And at one stage, a rumour went around that Charlie had been assassinated. And there was people rioting, throwing stones in the street. And I heard that from a friend of mine from Derry, grew up at the time. His father was a doctor, friendly with Charlie. And he remembers as a teenager this happening. So it was a totally surreal situation he found himself in. And then he had his problems with alcoholism. Then there would have been a measure of regret at the end of the 60s, because Cavan were still holding themselves to sort of a standard from a different era. Like, there would have been a feeling that Cavan had failed in the 60s, even though we look back on it now as a glorious era. Hmm. But there would have been probably a bit of regret there with him as well, that Cavan didn't get an All-Ireland and they held themselves to a really high standard. So, you know, all of that combined, and I don't know, maybe it was genetic as well, but yeah, he had a very bad time with alcoholism. And to be fair to the Gallagher family, like, they were very open about it, and his teammates. And there was one really sad story, probably the saddest story in the book. One of his teammates told me how he met Charlie at a match years later, and Charlie had a good few drinks on him, and he was the worse for wear. And he decided, I won't call it an intervention, but he decided he'd try and have a word with him. And he said to him, you know, Charlie, why don't you come and play golf with us? He said, some of us, the lads that used to play together in the football field, he said, we're playing golf. He said, we're no good, but it's a good hobby and stuff like that. And he said, for a second, he thought he was getting through to Charlie. And then he just said, do you remember the time you kicked the ball down to me and I put it over the bar? And he said, for a split second, it was like I could get through to him. And then it was back to football chat. So he never moved on from it, which is probably a common thread with sports people as well, sadly.
Yeah, look, we don't want to give everything away from the book. Like, it's a brilliant book. It's really, I think it'll strike home with a lot of people, because there's a lot that resonates with people. There's a star, the superstar, there's the troubles as well. Like, I think when you read it, you think of every club in the country probably has somebody that was close to this or similar enough to this. It's a magical story about a footballer that we really should know a lot more about. It's Charlie, the story of Charlie Gallagher, the GAA's lost icon. It's definitely going to be top of the Christmas list for a lot of people this Christmas. Can the good days ever come back for Cavan football? Can it ever go back around in a circle again in Ulster?
It's a hard question to ask. You know, I think it's accepted by some of the Cavan players. I know a friend of mine did an interview with one of the Cavan players yesterday, which hasn't been released yet, and he was saying how Tyrone and Donegal are ahead of Cavan in terms of strength and condition. That, I think that's accepted by the Cavan players. They believe that the young players coming into the Tyrone and Donegal teams are lagging behind in strength and conditions. That's one thing that needs to be addressed. Cavan have appointed a full-time strength and condition coach to work at all levels, which should help that. Can it come around again? The population of Cavan is rising, which is, you know, if you're going to break it down to the nuts and bolts, like, it is a numbers game. And traditionally we would have had slightly bigger population than Monaghan, for example, but the projections are now that our population is going to be significantly bigger than Monaghan in the years to come. So if we can beat Monaghan, we'd be happy.
Yeah, exactly. If you can beat Monaghan, we'd be happy. Paul, thanks for coming into OTBM this morning.
Thanks very much, Tommy, for having me.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Interesting books actually around in Irish sport, and always nice to reminisce about a time when Gaelic football was nowhere near as professional as it is now. You know, lads kind of trained in a ditch. I did find quite noticeable about this weekend, there was an awful lot of social media stuff about the club games, and it was really celebrated. Like interviews about, obviously, guys up in the north. I think one of the Derry guys who was talking about, you know, praying to his mother at the end of the game, and some amazing skills as well in some of the clips. And you're kind of, this is then kind of compared to the two tier stuff that's going on, and there's a lot of a downbeat attitude about the inter-county game at the moment in terms of the dominance of your beloved Dubs.
Yeah, well, see, the club game gives you that access where I've been lucky enough to, when I worked for Dublin Station, you got to, automatically what you did was you followed the club of the Dublin champions and their journey in Leinster. And But you get great access. I actually even remember
access as well. It was actually Danny Haven who was speaking to Thomas Niblock, captain of the Rossa Gales in Derry, that piece.
Yeah, but just even like the players as well, they'll say what they're actually thinking, where they're not on guard, whereas with inter-county players, the way it's gone now, they're terrified, because if they say something and it gets put in the paper, then it can be put up in a dressing room all of the opposition, and they'll probably get a telling off for it, and then they won't be put up for media duties again. Whereas with the club game, these are lads as well that have grown up with each other.
Yeah.
And, you know,
Now was like what the inter-county game used to be, maybe 20.
It's got a bit of the magic in it, all right. Yeah, like you saw that with Mullinocta last year, like, you know, where they upset the odds to get to win a Leinster title. So, and even going back to stories of like the 50s, I was actually only talking to my mum about this a few weeks ago, because my granddad used to play for Donegal, but like where my mum grew up, Ballyshannon, like it's right down the south of Donegal, so you know they're cycling to games, him and his brother, so my great uncle, the two of them would have lived side by side, they played for Donegal together, they'd cycle to games together, but putting in savage journeys on a bike just to go to a game. Like different
areas. And in those days, when you went to a game on a Sunday, you dressed up in your best finery, be it what you wore at Mass.
Yeah.
And it was only like the jerseys only came in, I'd say, maybe the 80s and 90s. I think the Dubs actually changed the culture of, the Dubs had more like a soccer type support, which was completely unknown in Gaelic games at that time. But that's probably an interesting idea for my off the ball overlords, a discussion on what's more fun now, the club game or the inter-county game, in terms of where it's going. But I do have to remind you of a competition all week on OTB AM. We'll be giving you the opportunity to win UEFA Champions League quarter-final tickets, and it's all thanks to Pepsi Max, one of the proud sponsors of the Champions League. Keep an eye out for their promotional packs, which you can win this week. Also, to be in with the chance of winning this morning, just send us a comment wherever you're watching the show of your favourite Champions League goal, and it is Pepsi Max, maximum taste, no sugar. Any, we have a couple of comments coming in here. Jack Queeley, Gareth Bale's overhead in the final against Liverpool. Pretty unmemorable moment for a lot of people as well. Came on as a sub and had a point to prove against manager and Real Madrid fans. Great goal. It was an unbelievable goal. Dara Hayes, Divock Origi's goal against Barcelona, just for the pure quick thinking of Trent Alexander-Arnold. Absolutely, amazing thinking from a corner kick, and one of the best games you'll ever see, I think, from the Champions League perspective. Gerard Lynch, Gerard versus Olympiacos 2005, that's an epic goal in a game in which Gerard didn't actually do a great deal. Any thoughts yourself, Phil?
Gerard had that habit, though, of being able to come up with those big moments. John Giles often described him as a good player that can do great things.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a great player.
He modelled himself from Roy Keane.
Yeah.
But they were very, very different.
Yeah. Well, see, also, like, in fairness to Gerard, he was playing in a far inferior team than Roy Keane would have been playing. Gerard, for a long time with Liverpool, had to do a lot on his own. Because you looked around and he didn't have the players there to help him. Like, the best team he played in at Liverpool probably would have been the Benitez team that came second to United.
Yeah, and they kind of had,
I know they obviously, the Suarez team obviously would have been close, but the all round team, Liverpool were a lot more solid. They had Alonso there, they had a decent back four, whereas what ultimately let Liverpool down in 2013-14 was their defence and their goalkeeper.
Yeah, absolutely.
They scored goals, but they couldn't defend.
I did I did like listening to Roy on at the weekend talking about the guys kind of hugging and, you know, kissing each other from the opposition in the tunnel. And obviously you're comparing him and Vieira, and we're talking about, you know, old eras in Gaelic games, but he comes from another era. And
yeah,
I have to, like, in fairness, as much as, you know, I was quite critical of his performance in the Borgosh Energy Theatre. I thought he was out of order at times, but, like, you got to love that passion as well, that drive, like, just, you're going to war here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think when I watch him now, though, because, say, Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher have set the bar very high in terms of punditry and the insight that they give into the modern game, I don't think we get that from Roy Keane, where if he's trying to break down a game, he's not going to go into like a big tactical breakdown. You know, he kind of comes from that school of thought of, you know, heart, passion, characters, leaders, that kind of...
This is why his and O'Neill's axis was so badly thought out. If the FAI had done any background here, Martin O'Neill is not a coach, and anyone will tell you that. He's like a motivator. If you ask any player that Roy Keane played, that played under them, I guarantee you he'll tell you he's not. That's like, coaching's not his thing. That's fine. Brian Clough wasn't really a coach, but that's Roy Keane's problem now. And that I'm not sure where he goes from here. But he does need some proper coach with him that can actually do stuff in the training ground, because you're absolutely right. His tactical nous is actually very, very average.
Yeah, because he played in a team which obviously had so many creative players around that now he could more than hold his own. He knew what his purpose was on the pitch. Brilliant passer of the ball. That's sometimes, you know, people don't realise. I know Wayne Rooney described him as the best passer he played with, because he just, the
crisp,
simple things. But do you know what? Even the simple thing, like a fullback is advancing, that he plays the ball, that the fullback doesn't have to break stride. I know it sounds so simple,
it's not, though.
If it's played a little bit behind, it takes a sting out of the attack. He just did that, all that very well. But yeah, he knew exactly what he had to do on the pitch. But tactics and the tactical breakdown is something that you won't get from him. But what you do get is, you do get entertainment.
Yeah.
If you're looking for punditry to entertain you, Roy Keane certainly does that. Even the other day when he looked at the, like, just the comment, like, what are you staring at?
Yeah.
The Harry Kane stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. No, he's still compelling. Speaking of compelling, here's Phil with the sports news.
Yeah, yeah.
In a Phil Egan voice.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Still waiting on this impression.
Ah, sure. Look, the lads couldn't get the job done against the Swiss last week. But we'll start with Harry Kane and co, because big game for Tottenham tonight. Obviously, got to the final of the Champions League last season. Haven't started the group well, which is similar to last season as well. They were hammered 7-2 by Bayern Munich, so 1 point from two games. Now they can get back on track in Group C that they're in. No, they're in Group B, rather. So they have two games against Red Star Belgrade. They're at home tonight. We might see Giovanni Lo Celso feature. Hasn't really played that much since he moved, but he's returned to full fitness. Manchester City have started Group C with two wins from two. Pep Guardiola's side are at home to Italian outfit Atalanta. Kyle Walker and Nicolas Otamendi missed the win over Crystal Palace at the weekend. Both have returned to training. John Stones could also feature following his recovery from a thigh injury. City played without recognised centre-halves against Palace. They did okay. You know, they're fine, because once they hold on to the ball, they don't really need really good centre halves.
I think Liverpool fans are getting nervous already, to be honest. Like, six.
I think City will win the league.
Yeah, so do I.
And if there was 6 points to go with five games, or 6 points in it with five games to go, I'd still be worried, because from what I remember, Liverpool have a really tough run in compared to City's. City have, like, you're looking, their last six games are shoe-ins, whereas Liverpool have a load of tricky games. But City, Spurs, both games kick off at 8 o'clock. There's one game in the SSE, or Tricity League Premier Division, tonight. That's a 7:45 start. It's Derry City at home to St. Pat's.
I'm thinking of going. Just kind of,
yeah.
Derry probably sealing secure European football, having to the Brandywell this season.
How long would that take you?
Three and a half hours.
I remember, obviously, Celtic Park is
right beside it.
Yeah, so I remember Dublin were playing Derry. This is a league game a few years ago. Derry actually beat Dublin. This is Jim Gavin's Dublin as well. Didn't have a car at the time. Got a bus.
Oh,
left
geez.
At 6 o'clock in the morning on the Sunday, after being in Parnell Park the night before to see Dublin beat Kilkenny in the league in the hurling. and got to Strabane, and they told me that's the end. So there's a few Dove supporters.
You get to Strabane, this is the end.
They said there's no, like, that's, you have to get off the bus. So I was like, how am I getting to Derry? So there was a few Dublin supporters on the bus as well, and we were all in the same boat. We all chipped in.
All on the taxi, same bus, as it were.
All on the same bus, and we got a taxi, and got there.
Derry beat Dublin.
Watch Derry beat Dublin, yeah.
But what else do we have?
England head coach Eddie Jones in fine form at his press conference this morning. And
when is he not in fine form?
Some man for stirring the pot.
Yeah, he
obviously has put all the pressure onto New Zealand. He said all the pressure is on them. And he said that New Zealand journalists, he was asked about them. He said, they're just fans of keyboards. They don't ask questions of this team. He said, you know, as an England coach, there's been talk of me getting sacked so many times. You don't get that with the New Zealand press. He said all the pressure's on the All Blacks, and he also claimed that somebody had filmed the training session from an apartment block in Tokyo, which if you see the pictures of where they trained, it'd be quite easy to do. So 9 o'clock Saturday morning should be a good one. We know that Nigel Owens is going to be the referee for that one, and one man not considered for that was Jaco Pieper. The South African referee, he's apologised after posing for a picture with Wales fans where he appeared to mock an elbow, which led to the red card he gave to French second row Sebastian Fahamahina in their quarter final on Sunday. Jerome Garces of France, by the way, will do the Wales and South Africa game.
Don't pose the fans if you're a referee. Yeah.
No, it wasn't the wisest choice.
Speaking of posing the fans, got to mention Paul Chute, the League of Ireland referee, who happily posed with League of Ireland players on Ireland trips when they got to the Euros. He had his last game just at the weekend, and really, really popular referee, and wishing Paul all the best post League of Ireland. Thanks for that, Phil.
No worries. He's probably in Tbilisi as well, isn't he?
Don't think he was. Yeah, I do remember seeing a potentially future FAI CEO mingling with fans there. Noel Mooney was mingling with fans in one of the bars, but there were a lot of people in Tbilisi, some of them still trying to get over it, and Geneva. That's pretty much our lot for the morning. The Universities of Illinois and Nebraska have been confirmed for the 2021 Aer Lingus College Football Classic. Holiday packages for both the 2020 and 21 games are on sale now through the official corporate hospitality game partner, and that is corporate.ie. And Adrian Barry caught up with Josh Whitman, the athletics director at the University of Illinois, earlier this week for a chat, and here's how they got on.
All right, the 2021 Aer Lingus College Football Classic is coming to Dublin. It's just been announced that it's going to be the University of Illinois up against the Nebraska Cornhuskers, the brilliantly named Cornhuskers. It's the second, of course, of that five-game series, and it's going to be on Saturday, the 28th of August, 2021. I'm delighted to say to look ahead to the game. We're joined on the line by the Director of Athletics at the University of Illinois, Josh Whitman. Josh, in a sporting sense, looking ahead to this game, was it a tough decision for the university to give up home advantage and uproot and travel the 6,000 kilometres to Dublin?
Well, it certainly isn't something that we do easily. It's we take our home games seriously, as most schools do. But ultimately, the opportunity to take our student athletes to Dublin, to give them the opportunity to experience the Irish culture and travel abroad, was really compelling for me, and I know exciting for our coaches. We think it's and then back here at home, it's a great opportunity for us to get a jump start on the college season. We'll play in what we call week zero here, which is the week before most schools start to play, which will give us a national television audience, a big platform, and chance to show all those here who are paying attention to college football that the University of Illinois has got a great program and a program on the rise.
I think I'm right to say the first discussions kicked off about 2 years ago.
It did, yeah. I was approached by the organizers of the game, I believe, in November of 2017. And so we've been talking back and forth since then, looking at different dates, trying to determine different opponents. And ultimately, this game in 2021 against Nebraska made the most sense for us, and we were able to find a willing partner in Nebraska, and we were in a good position then to move the conversations forward fairly quickly.
What are the main types of challenges that you face with bringing a game like this so far across the ocean?
I think it's a lot of different things. Certainly, as you said, it's making sure that from a scheduling perspective, you're moving the right opponent. In my mind, if we were looking for somebody that would be a high-profile opponent, but also somebody who does who our fans wouldn't necessarily miss because we see them frequently. So in our world here, we divide our Big Ten Conference into the West Division, the East Division. We play the West Division opponents every other year at home. The East Division opponents may only come to our home stadium every 8 or 9 years. And so, you know, if we were going to talk about a University of Michigan or a Penn State University, those are in the East Division. They only come to town here every 8 or 9 years. And so I wasn't going to take one of those games away. But Nebraska, a great tradition, great program. But they come here to Champaign every other year. And so I was a little more willing to think about moving them across. Also, it needed to fall at the right point in our schedule. We needed to feel comfortable with the games that were on either side of it, because, of course, this is a little bit more of a travel piece than what we would have to play in our region here. And then financially, it needed to make sense for us. We needed to be sure that we weren't sacrificing the revenues that come with a home football game. And thankfully, to the organizers of the game, to Aer Lingus and a lot of the other partners, including some different government entities that you have over there in Ireland, they were able to put together an attractive package for us that made it pretty straightforward. And once we recognized that that all those boxes could be checked, like I said, for me, it was just about giving our student athletes that opportunity to experience your incredible culture over there.
I was over at the Notre Dame Navy game a couple of weeks ago in Chicago, and we were in conversation at that point with John Anthony of Anthony Travel, who's involved obviously with Irish American events and who are responsible ultimately for bringing these games across the water. And we were having a conversation about the importance of the head coach in these conversations, and I just wondered from your point of view about the head coach from a football perspective at the University of Illinois, and how much of a sales job you had to do on him to get this game to come over here.
Not a lot, to be honest. I have a lot of respect for Lovie Smith, our head football coach. He certainly always talks about putting the man before the football player, and I think he saw this for what it is. He saw it as a great chance to provide a once in a lifetime experience to the members of our team. I think he sees it as a tremendous recruiting pitch, and to be able to talk to prospective student athletes, people who might enroll here next year or the year after, about the opportunity to travel overseas. And it's a feather in the cap for the program. You look at some of the other teams that have played over there. Certainly you mentioned Notre Dame, but Navy, Boston College, Penn State, Georgia Tech, University of Central Florida. Those are some very recognizable brands in college football here in the United States. And for us to be amongst that group and to be asked to participate in this early season event with the national stage it provides is a great opportunity for Illinois football, and he recognized that, and I appreciated that from him.
Josh, can I ask you, when we were over at that game in Notre Dame, I sat in a presentation by your Notre Dame counterpart, Jack Swarbrick, who's the AD there, and he spoke quite eloquently about the challenge that faces college sports in the US now in relation to image rights and that entire area. And I know Corey Brooker has weighed in on that particular topic over the last few days as well. In terms of solutions, where do you think this pretty thorny issue is headed?
Well, I wish I came with a ready solution. I think a lot of us have done a good job of identifying some of the challenges, recognizing some of the complexities to the issue. But as yet, we've yet to identify the perfect solution, which I think is why it's taken so long for us to act. You know, it's one of those things where I think politicians, I think members in the media sometimes see it just in theory, but when you try and distill it down to reality, it gets complicated in a hurry. But I think it's an incredibly important issue, and one that certainly I think is going to have a lot to do with what college athletics here in the States looks like for the next several decades. And so it's important that we get it right. I think it's a solution that needs to originate from the NCAA, probably not from the state governments, although they're starting to put their stamp on it as well. And so, you know, we're going to have to navigate through some difficult waters here and try and get out to the other side with a good solution.
And just looking at your recent results, Josh, they particularly, obviously, a very recent game in the last few weeks, indeed, against the Cornhuskers 3 weeks ago, and it was a really tight game that just slipped away from you, I think, towards the end of it. But we'd taken equally close game here in Dublin in 2021?
Well, we would too. I tell you, we're a program on the rise. We're really excited about the build that we've been undertaking, and that was a tight game against Nebraska. That was one of those games you get in the car afterward and think, boy, that might have just taken a couple of years off my life. We were up a couple scores at different points during the game and weren't able to pull it out in the end, which was disappointing. Certainly not for me, but for the guys on the team and for the coaches. They worked so hard to try and put themselves in a position to be successful, and they're continuing that hard work, and we're looking forward to having a great game against Nebraska when we're over there in 2 years.
All right, Josh Whitman is the athletics director at the University of Illinois. Thanks, William, for taking our call today. No doubt we'll catch up over the next few months in the lead into this game. And a reminder as well that it is the Universities of Illinois and Nebraska coming to Dublin in August 2021. It's going to be an epic game. It's the second in that five-game series, and the hospitality package for both the 2020 game and the 21 games are on sale now through the official corporate hospitality game partner, corporate.ie.
Thanks to Josh and Adrian there. And that's pretty much our lot for OTBM this morning. But we are giving you the chance to win UEFA Champions League quarterfinal tickets all week. And it's all thanks to Pepsi Max, one of the proud sponsors of the UEFA Champions League. We have a daily winner each morning who will go into Friday's final. And each morning you can win a Pepsi Max promotional pack. And this morning we ask you to send us your favourite Champions League goal. And the winner is, listening on Go Loud, Luis Garcia's ghost goal is definitely my favourite. Remember, clearly enough, it was around 7 at the time when it happened. Do we actually have the name of that winner there? Darren Hennessy. So congratulations to Darren. Darren is our winner today. Luis Garcia's ghost goal, definitely my favourite. Remember, it clearly enough, was around 7 at the time. Check in tomorrow morning for another chance to win. It's Pepsi Max, maximum taste, no sugar. That's it from us this morning on OTBM. Thanks very much for joining us, particularly those who've been here since 7:30, along with myself and Andy Lee. Stay tuned to Off the Ball channels and OTB Sports Radio throughout the day. If you missed anything from OTBM this morning, we had rugby with Rory O'Connor. I pressed Rory on the future of Johnny Sexton and also Joe Schmidt's legacy. We had football with Gary Breen. Gary Breen reiterating his opinion on Declan Rice and Grealish and the guys who decide not to play for Ireland. We had the sports pages with Andy Lee. We spoke a little bit about the dementia conversations in the paper this morning, and the story of Charlie Gallagher, the fascinating story of Charlie Gallagher, who's been compared to George Best, a former Cavan footballer from yesteryear, with a big book coming out at the end of the year. You can catch the podcast back on offtheball.com/podcast or the Go Loud app. Watch back on our YouTube channel and subscribe. Tonight on Off the Ball from 7 p.m, Damien Delaney. No mess around with Damien Delaney. He's in studio for the Champions League and an interview with Desi Hutchinson. We'll see you tomorrow morning on OTBAM at 7:30 a.m. Ger Gilroy and the man Owen Sheehan. Is Owen Sheehan back? He's back. It'll be interesting to do interviews with sober people now. Ger Gilroy and the man himself, Owen Sheehan, will be back in the studio. And that's it for this morning on OTBAM.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.